rules, which are attached under the blue agenda page. And unless something has changed, then they should be what we worked on.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated October 1st, 2009.
Vice Chair Van Orman moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated October 1, 2009. Is there any discussion? Without further discussion, would the clerk call the roll?
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Gillian?
Aye.
Representative Dillon?
Aye.
Representative
Winger?
Aye.
Representative
Byer? Excused.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Van Krieger?
Excused.
Chair
Pence? Just call him Van Krieger. That was awesome. We're gonna start doing that the whole time now. Yeah. We're going to call him that the whole time today. Chair votes aye. Motion passes. The rules are adopted. There's Van Krieger. So our first, maybe I'll just talk for a second about, you know, what we've got here in theory. Today we've got a variety of things around agenda items around kind of the economics of agriculture and some of the challenges it's facing, and positive, proactive things that we're doing and probably should do more of, and our neighboring state is doing, and I thought we could get some ideas from them. And then we've got some not-so-fun discussions about pests that are and invasive species. Hear a little bit about our firefighting season. And then we had two bills that passed this committee that met an untimely demise, either by being used for something else or one, I'm not totally clear why, but it got added to Ways and Means after it had already passed the House, 59-1 or 60-0, and then it went to Ways and Means and the clock ran out on it. So these were the two I could find that passed here that didn't really seemingly have fiscal problems, unlike Farm to School, which passed here but ran into a fiscal problem. And I thought we'd look at those again, potentially for committee bills for February. But wanted to have some public input first to see if the committee's still interested in these two issues. And any questions about that? I just want to get going. All right. So let's start with our director of our Oregon Department of Agriculture, Katie Koba. And this must be Nathan.
Nope. But I'm going to introduce you to him.
Okay. Oh, 850, not 805 for Nathan. That's why. I was like, that doesn't look like Nathan. I've met Nathan. No.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. With me is Gary Roth. He is the administrator of our Ag Development and Marketing Division. So he's here in case I can't answer questions that you may have about our work on the economic development side. So to get going, this morning I thought I would give you kind of an overview of what is going on in agriculture right now. I wish I had good news, but I don't, and that's the reality of what we're facing. And I'll go through some details on that, and then talk about some of the things that we do in our everyday work, whether things are going well in agriculture or not. We have a very, very good marketing program. It's more than just our Ag Development and Marketing Division, and a lot of our programs are recognized on the national and international level. So with that, we'll get started. If I can make sure I know how to make this thing work. That's not moving. There it is. There we go. Yay. So kind of a picture of what's going on. The green bars are gross farm gate, and then the yellow bars are net farm gate. So the yellow bars represent what farmers are actually making after they take their costs out. And as you can see from this slide, it's expensive to farm anywhere. It's not unusual. The challenge that we're facing right now, and I think everyone heard, was the fact that costs, just as prices ran up in 2007 and 2008, costs just went through the roof. Fertilizer, pesticides, you name it. And what we're seeing, obviously, this represents 2008. We're expecting 2009 gross farm sales numbers to be down. Costs are starting to come down, but not at the same pace that the value that, that producers are receiving. The largest single component of costs on a farm are labor costs, and Oregon ranks fairly high in terms of states around the U.S. in terms of our labor costs. You that have heard me talk about agriculture in the past know that if I use one word to describe Oregon agriculture, it's diversity. We are incredibly diverse. Mixture of nursery products, hay, wheat, specialty crops, and we'll go into those in more details as we go through the presentation. But clearly, the diversity of our crops and markets is indeed one of our greatest strengths. But the size and scope of the current downturn is affecting just about every sector. And typically what we see when we have a downturn is we'll have, you know, maybe half the sectors down and but half up. And unfortunately, with the exception of onions in Oregon right now, just about everything else is down. And so we are truly struggling like other economic sectors in Oregon and the U.S. Just a reminder that half of what we produce in Oregon you don't eat, or at least we don't eat. Animals do eat some of those things that we produce. And then a very, very critical fact, and I know the chair is very cognizant of this, 80% of what we produce in Oregon is sold outside of our state's borders, and half of that moves into an international market. So when I talk about markets and our marketing programs, I really stress that it's a three-legged stool. We need our local markets. There's great synergy, great opportunities for Oregon producers in a local market, but we cannot forget our domestic and international markets either. In terms of ag's contribution to Oregon's economy, when you take the farm gate sales, when you add all the processing, the warehousing, transportation, all of those components, it's a $25.8 billion economic sector. It represents 10% of Oregon's gross domestic product, and 1 in 10 Oregon jobs derive their existence from agriculture. So what are the challenges that we're facing? And these are challenges that we had, frankly, even before the economic downturn. We're seeing incredible consolidation in the food industry. Food and agriculture is truly a global phenomenon. It is not a state, regional, domestic. It is truly a global phenomenon. Invasive species, which you're going to hear about more later this morning, and you've heard from us before, as people and product move, things come in, they hitch rides and come in, and it's a big challenge for us in the United States. Obviously, border states, Oregon, Washington, California, Texas, Florida, New Mexico tend to be the front line, but oftentimes what we see is movement of invasives from California north, and I tease my counterpart in California. He always sends us all these things that we really don't want. Global issues always, certainly now with the global recession, but even prior to the economic downturn, import and export competition and the value of the dollar always impact the money that we receive and in the farm gate value that we receive in Oregon. As I'd mentioned, expenses are a big issue for the industry right now, and labor costs. And then something that many of you dealt with during the legislative session, and I say it's very simple for us to be successful in agriculture. There's a couple of key things we need, land and water, to start with, and we all know the challenges that we're facing around land use and water quantity and water quality. So what does agriculture in Oregon look like? Latest census had us at 38,500 farms. I think a very, very critical point that a lot of people, even in Oregon, don't realize. 98% of agriculture in Oregon is a family operation. It's sole proprietor, partnerships, or family corporations. I know my own family. It's my dad and my brother, and it's incorporated, but definitely a family farm. Less than 1% of operations in Oregon are non-family corporations. Average age of the farmer is 57 years old and getting older, although I must say that I'm pretty excited to see a lot of people, young people, are coming back to the farm for a number of different reasons, but it is good to see. This slide is initially a little bit daunting, but it's very, very critical, I think, for you to understand this and who are Oregon's producers, and it helps explain some of the challenges that we're facing in Oregon agriculture. So we have kind of picked these three categories: full-time commercial farm operators, the straddlers, and then the part-timers, lifestylers. A lot of people call them the martini farmers. Full-time commercial farm operators, these are the operations that have sales of greater than $250,000. It represents 7% of the farms in Oregon. They control half of the acreage, but they produce 85% of the value of Oregon's total agricultural output. So really, when you're talking about where the bulk of Oregon's agriculture comes from, it's from these 2,700 operations with sales of $250,000 or higher. The straddlers represents about 10,000 of those, that total 38,500. These are operations that have sales between 10,000 and 250,000. Represents 25% of the farms, 36% of the acreage, and produce about 14% of the value of Oregon's output. And then the third category, the part-timers, lifestylers, obviously the bulk of the number of operations. Sales of less than $10,000 represent 68% of the farms, 16% of the acreage, but produces less than 2% of the value of the total output. What we're seeing in terms of agriculture in Oregon is a real squeeze on the straddlers. So in order to remain competitive in Oregon, you either have to grow and move into the full-time commercial farm operations, or you shrink down and become a part-timer or a lifestyler.
Can you, do you know how many of that straddler group actually have possibly a full-time job outside of the farming? A lot of them have had to go there in order to make it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I would say the vast majority of the straddlers have work outside of the farm. Use my family farm as an example. My brother has a hired hand, and he works full-time, and his wife works full-time. So oftentimes they'll work full-time outside, or the spouse does, and they rely a lot on that spouse income to survive.
Question?
Vice Chair Van Orden.
But that's been going on for quite some time, this idea that the farmer farms and the spouse teaches school, especially where I came from.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman, you're absolutely correct. This is not just a new phenomenon due to the recent economic downturn.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nolan.
Ms. Koba, do we know how that compares with other economic activities? This is not a phenomenon unique to agriculture either. There are certainly other economic endeavors where someone has a full or substantial time job in one area, and moonlights or weekends or seasonally does some other activity. And it's sounding like some of the straddlers, and I would bet virtually everyone in the lower group, fits that category. I mean, in my industry in technology, that's certainly not at all unusual. Someone might have a full-time job program, you know, writing software programs for someone else, and then they've got a business that they do on their on the side. And it sounds, help me understand whether
Sure.
this isn't analogous to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I would say, let's look at the last 20 years. I would say the part-timers, lifestylers category did not start out to be full-time farmers, that they maybe picked up the farming as a hobby, or, you know, something they do in the evenings, what have you. The straddlers, on the other hand, were full-time farm operations. And because of the economics the industry has faced, have had to move away, have had to get that second job, have had to either expand and try to get into the top category, or what have you. So, and the reason I mention this is you also hear a lot about big operations versus small, corporate farms versus family farms. And that's why I'm trying to give you a snapshot of agriculture in Oregon. We are not like Midwest agriculture, where you may have a state that's dominated by corporate operation. we really are a family farm in Oregon, but we still get this sense of, you know, if you're big, you're big, and what we're trying to save is a small family farm. And the small family farm, which I would categorize as the straddlers, is either having to move and gain land, gain employees, or they really are struggling and moving into becoming more of a part-timer lifestyler. So I would expect in the future we would see even less in the middle category, and you would see more either moving to the top or the small category. And it does have implications when we talk about regulation, as an example, and this notion of trying to save the family farm.
Hello, Representative Nolan.
Two factors affecting this. One is the value of the product that they're produced, that is being produced, because even 20 years ago, no one was living off of a farm that only sold $10,000 gross. I mean, you couldn't survive. Your earlier slide suggested that, and maybe costs have gone up to shrink the margin so that it's about 5% of gross is what you actually put in your pocket to make your living expenses. So 20 years ago, even if it was 15% that you were saving, no one was living off of $10,000. Someone might have been able to support a family off of a $250,000 gross when costs were a little bit lower. So is the value of the product shrinking? And that's part of what's contributing to this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, again, it's difficult to answer that question broadly for agriculture because we're so diverse in Oregon. Where we have tried to go and where our agency really pushes is the opportunities around value added. So where you have a true commodity type crop like wheat, trying to figure out a way to move it out of the commodity market and into value added is a goal, but it's a big challenge when you're dealing with wheat. So 20 years ago, 80s or early 80s are not a good example, but let's say pre-early 80s, the price of wheat is the same as it is now. Mm-hmm. Costs have gone up significantly. So where farmers in the wheat industry have, what they've had to do is become much more efficient or get to the point where they can produce more on their acreage, and really in the last 20 years we've not seen a whole lot of output increases, bushels per acre, if you will. Flip side, on the value-added side, blueberries is a great example. Probably not much of a blueberry industry in Oregon 20 years ago. It was doing very well a couple of years ago, where basically production has gone up, and that's impacted prices. But being able to figure out higher-value products for producers really helps. But you still get this phenomenon, and producers will move from one sector to the other where they can. In eastern Oregon, oftentimes they can't. In the Willamette Valley, you can move from one crop type to another in certain locations. So it's hard to answer that given the diversity of Oregon agriculture. I hope that helps.
Okay, we got three questions. Representative Krieger, then Roblin, then Van Roman.
I guess the questioner may be kind of a statement. Key, right now, if you don't take the valley, but west of the Cascades, I'll bet you 50% or more of those operations are ag forestry.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And with no opportunity in forestry right now, your costs of an, you know, forestry harvesting operation and taxes and replanting, it's just about there's no profit there at all. So those people, I think, have been, and the other part of that is ag can have a crop every year. Forestry, you may have 30, 40-year gap on a small piece of property unless you really are managing it carefully. So they have, when I had my tree farm all those years, I had a full-time job as a state policeman, but I worked that tree farm for 14 years without a day off to make it something someday. And so they don't have that crop every year like you do in most of the ag products, and they have to make that commitment. And I think people need to understand that it's an environmental commitment to the environment and to the sustainability of the, not only the forest, but everything that's there. You know, the land, the water, the air, the wildlife, everything. Because at my age, 69 years old, if I plant a tree today, 30 years from now, I don't know. probably not going to be here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I would agree with you.
I'm not going to be here. I'm not going to be here, I'll tell you.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, I would agree with that, too.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Well, I think in the discussion of all of this, is that I'm still trying to figure out this pricing thing. Because, you know, the dairy industry right now is really suffering tremendously because of pricing. And I can remember years ago, the berry industry was pretty much dependent upon whatever Smucker's was going to pay. And so, for me, a lot of the issues revolve around this pricing. And so, at some point in time, I'm hoping that I can understand it. But it sounds like, to me, a lot of it is the pricing factor that farmers face that really don't have any control over that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman, you're correct, and we're going to get into some slides
okay.
in a minute here that speaks to that a little bit more. But
okay,
it's this whole notion of moving out of being a price taker and becoming a price maker. And some operations or some products can do that. Others, dairy, forget it, you know, unless you're going into specialty cheeses. Okay. You guys are going to have to help me stay on time. So kind of a picture of what's going on currently, a day in the life of three full-time Oregon farm families. Wheat. Average production per farm is about 50,000 bushels. Current wheat market is 50 cents a bushel below break-even. So if you are that average production category on 50,000 bushels of production this year, you lost $25,000. Dairy, which is probably the sector that is hurting, I think dairy and grass seed are competing with each other. On average, Oregon dairy farmers have been producing milk below cost of production for the last 10 months. Average loss of $100 per cow per month. And currently, if you have a 350-cow dairy, you're losing $420,000 a year. Grass seed, 200-acre perennial ryegrass. Grass seed farmer produces about 290,000 pounds of seed. Break-even cost is 62 cents a pound. Current prices are 10 cents below break-even. So if you're this average farmer, you're losing $29,000 on your crop. Agriculture in Oregon, these are our top six sectors, greenhouse and nursery, followed by hay, grass seed, cattle, dairy, and wheat. You can see their components, and then we produce over 220 different commodities in Oregon, so the sum total of all of those gets us to our total farm gate value of right about $5 billion. So taking a look at a snapshot of some of these top sectors, and you can explain, it helps explain why we're struggling in Oregon. Greenhouse and nursery is our number one largest sector. It's been hit incredibly hard by the housing downturn. People aren't building, they're not buying plants. Even if they have a home, they're probably not investing in new plants right now. Sales are down $120 million from this time last year. We're seeing a reduction in our license revenue because our licenses are based on sales dollars, so still the same number of licenses, but they're falling down into a lower category. So our own nursery license revenue is decreasing. And the industry is looking for alternative markets. You can see the numbers 07, 08, and I would expect 09 probably in all of these slides will be down even further. So what are we doing? And this, again, is not something that we've just started in the last year, but I think our work becomes more significant, focusing in on new markets for nursery products. We have been involved in market development work in Japan and China ever since I've come on board the Department of Agriculture with the nursery industry, particularly focusing around the greening initiative in China for the Beijing Olympics. 60 40-foot containers to China alone last year, and we're expecting similar numbers in 2010, represents $1.2 million in annual sales. If you can send, you know, those containers and get that kind of results back, that really helps people that are struggling in the nursery industry. The industry has really stepped up to try to become more efficient in their trucking costs, and we've worked with them to help support them in that effort. And then a big issue that we deal with on a nonstop basis is tariff and non-tariff trade barriers. We've been working on Mexico tariff barriers to help negotiate the 50-50 cost sharing of the new 20% tariff down in Mexico. grass seed, obviously very much similar to nursery industry because of their market. 70% of the world's supply of grass seed is grown in Oregon, and we're the number one producing state in the United States. The challenge that we have is last year's crop was pretty much not sold. We've had this year's crop harvested, and we're sitting on huge inventories. Again, no new construction, so no demand for new grass seed, and what we're seeing in the golf course market in order to cut costs, that golf courses are actually spraying their greens with green spray paint as opposed to reseeding with grass seed. That's not a good sign for the grass seed industry. And then obviously increased costs and other factors. So we're really expecting a pretty large drop in 2009 in terms of grass seed sector. The Oregon Department of Agriculture supervises price negotiations in this industry. We've been doing so for some time, and part of our goal is to help prevent further market destruction. It's been a tough year to negotiate prices. Needless to say, we bring buyers and growers and dealers together to do that. Last year's 2008 price for perennial ryegrass was 80 cents a pound. This year it's 52 cents a pound. So you can see that significant drop in price. We continue to work looking for new offshore uses in reconstruction and conservation, particularly China, but looking in Afghanistan now. We've been very the grass seed industry has been very involved in China for a number of years. Tiananmen Square is actually planted with Oregon grass seed. And we look for new domestic uses. Took a trade mission back to the Midwest about 4 years ago in August. It was a wonderful time to be standing out in a cornfield. But using annual ryegrass as a cover crop, the ryegrass roots tend to go very, very deep in the soil, and then they spray out the grass in the spring and plant corn, and the corn roots can then follow where the grass roots were in the soil, and it's a tool that they're looking at more and more in the Midwest. On October 23rd, the Department of Agriculture and Oregon State University is hosting a summit bringing in grass seed producers and other experts to look at what's going on in the market and what alternatives might be available for Oregon's grass seed industry. Cattle. It's our second largest sector in Oregon. The interesting thing about beef production in Oregon is most of our beef is exported out of state to be processed. This has been an issue that the industry and the Department of Ag has been looking at for over 25 years. We've had over a period of time, Representative Krieger may remember, money that's been granted to the Department of Ag to work with the industry on trying to figure out if there's a way to develop meat processing within the state of Oregon. Bottom line, it's just a very difficult thing to do when you're competing with the big meat packers. The economies of scale just make it virtually impossible to have any kind of a small meat processing opportunities in Oregon. And you can see sales down on the beef side as well. So we've looked at a range of things to try to help with the beef producers in Oregon, and bottom line, financing, waste disposal, and low profitability really constrain any opportunities around doing beef processing here in Oregon. Dairy, not a good story here either. We have a national surplus of milk, and this is backed up with the overall recession. Break-even prices to cover both operating and variable costs for dairy is estimated to be about $17 per hundredweight. We're currently today at $12.50. We expect a lot of dairies in Oregon to go out of business. So we held a joint meeting, Oregon Department of Ag and Washington Department of Ag, with the Oregon and Washington dairy farmers in June to talk about what's going on. And we've been very involved with our national association in developing what's called a Meet the Need program. We were discussing this just a couple of weeks ago at our national meeting, and this is a federal proposal to basically, on the dairy side, buy down cheese inventories and move that protein into food banks and other places that need protein as they're giving food out. So there was a resolution passed and a program developed by NASDA. We're presenting that to Congress now. Really, the solutions around dairy are a federal level because it is a federal milk pricing process that sets dairy prices. In Oregon, we've been working some time with the industry on developing a specialty cheese market. So, again, moving from price taker to price maker, it's small, but we've got some great cheese producers in Oregon, and they've been winning international awards, so that's pretty exciting for us. Continuing to look at export market development in Hong Kong or southern China area for cheeses and ice cream. We actually sent some ice cream over there, got hung up, if I remember right, somewhere in some bureaucratic thing, and I'm not sure if the ice cream got freed out yet or not, but we were working on that challenge. And then a lot of work on the renewable energy side, methane digesters, a lot of you have heard, and seen if that's an option for helping with some of our dairy costs. Specialty crops, as I mentioned, 220 different commodities, tree fruits, vegetable crops, specialty seed, blueberries, blackberries. It's wonderful. It's what we know of Oregon agriculture. Cherries and blueberries, the largest harvest this year in years. Representative Clem probably knows this as well. A number of growers left cherries on the trees because the price was so low that it didn't cover their cost to even harvest them, so they just left cherries out on the trees. Export markets, however, have been stable, and we've had a lot of success with cherries, fresh blueberries into the export market. So if we can help that stabilize prices for some of our producers, that's a good thing. Just recently, Russia has been interested in Oregon potatoes. We were able to work the department in securing a Russian import permit for 2,000 metric tons of fresh potatoes and other vegetables. In my mind, I can't tell you what that looks like. I just know it's a lot. That's a good thing for our growers. The other thing that we're very, very involved in right now, I think a lot of you may have heard of the leafy green marketing order, which basically came out of when California was having challenges with E. coli and lettuce and spinach. And what California came up with was this leafy green marketing order in terms of how they handle their leafy green vegetables. We're seeing the market now wanting this for all kinds of fresh fruits and vegetables. So we're actually working in Oregon with our onion producers to develop a protocol for a similar kind of maximum residue level. MRL means a maximum residue level for pesticides as well as for other contaminants such as E. coli and salmonella. First place in the U.S. that we're developing a protocol around onions, and I would expect potatoes will be next. Crop diversification, maybe the good news with climate change. We've got some people in southern Oregon looking at olives, new strawberry varieties, organic tea, soybeans. We've had some producers in the Willamette Valley experimenting with cool season soybean varieties, wasabi. So we're always looking for other opportunities for diversification in Oregon agriculture. Market diversification, always looking at that, and I'm not sure how many of you are aware, but Harry and David, working with Truett Brothers here in Salem, moved for high-end specialty products instead of just your standard canned pears, moved to a glass pack pear, beautiful glass vase with pears beautifully arranged in it, and they get $12 for that glass jar as opposed to $2 for a can of pears. So again, places where we're looking to be price makers instead of price takers. Where the department works with other agencies, and we're always looking for partners, needless to say, for good agricultural practices, good handling practices, which is testing that's done in the field and in packing sheds. We've seen a $5.8 million growth in that industry. These are people that have gone to good agricultural practices, good handling practices, testing, and what they're getting in the market in terms of a benefit from that. We work with Department of Human Services on the Farm Direct Nutrition Programs, 1.5 million of coupons that come in for people to take advantage of buying fresh produce at farmers markets. Obviously, the Representative Clem's work on farm to school positions now in the Department of Ag and Department of Education to continue that effort. Working with testing so that we can move Oregon cherries into California. We had a little hang-up there with California, and we had to kind of jump in and try to help facilitate moving those cherries. It represented $10 million in sales that we could have lost if we couldn't have worked through that issue. And then supporting the Port of Portland to maintain upriver navigation for barges. Gary's quote was, dollar value on this, priceless. A lot of grants come through the Department of Agriculture that then go out to producers and food companies in Oregon. I won't go through these in detail unless you have a question about any of them, but we are a facilitator in terms of getting federal money out onto the ground to help producers and processors or other food companies. Total value here just in the last year of $10.8 million. So take-home messages. Yes, these are challenging times for agriculture, but as all of us in the industry know, we've faced it in the past. We're very good about talking about how tough it is, even in the good years. We're really good about talking about how tough it is in the bad years. I'm very optimistic that the industry, as in the past, will pull out of this. The diversity of crops and products and markets in Oregon is our greatest strength. It really helps to soften the blow when one sector suffers, unless they're all suffering. And that whole notion of the three-legged stool of markets, local, domestic, and international, is absolutely critical for Oregon agriculture. Government and marketplace regulation is a concern. I didn't speak a lot of this in the slides, but I think it's very, very important to note. And you will hear this, I think, when you hear the report that came out of the state of Washington. Government regulation is a very big concern for our industry. And even in this day and age, we are seeing almost a new interest, if you will, in terms of a regulatory approach, particularly from some of our federal partners, EPA, FDA, focus around CAFOs. The challenge that we have is it becomes much more difficult for small farm operations in Oregon to comply with new regulations than it does for big ones. And so this is a big challenge for us because, as we all talk about, we want to maintain that small family farm in Oregon. And I would say, even with that slide of the full-time commercial operators, $250,000 in gross sales a year is not a whole lot of money. And even these people we worry about. And so when we bring in new regulations, the ability of the smaller operators to comply with those regulations is a big challenge. The Department of Agriculture plays an important convening role in bringing the industry and other interested parties together to problem solve and brainstorm solutions. We think we're pretty good at it. This is a challenging time even for us. We will continue to work on the development of production, processing, and marketing of Oregon agriculture, and, again, focusing on opportunities at the local, regional, national, and international level. We need to maintain that market diversity. And I must say that we really do appreciate the support that our agency has received from the legislature during the last legislative session. It was a tough session. I thought we had very good opportunity to share our story and work on solving some of these problems, and we're going to need, I think, that support even more in the future. Right on time.
No kidding. Questions?
I just have a comment.
Comment, sure. Representative Van Orman.
Well, when I was in Wisconsin, I ate a cherry. And I think, oh, good, it's a cherry. And it wasn't an Oregon cherry. It was quite noticeably not an Oregon cherry. It was from Michigan. So I promptly, of course, sent Oregon cherries back to my friends in Milwaukee because I thought they ought to taste what a real good cherry tastes like. But then I've also sent pears and fruit, and my son loves blue cheese, and I tried to send him a Crater Lake Blue, and they only came in 5-pound wheels, and I knew that was too much for his family, so I ended up going through a store in St. Louis to get him, you know, a smaller portion. So those are the kinds of things I'm sure that everybody's thinking about, but I'm hoping and I'm presuming that there are more people doing what I'm doing, is sharing, because I think we take for granted. I mean, when I tasted that cherry, I just assumed it was going to taste like what I'm familiar with, and it was not.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was not a pie cherry. It was a Bing, and it just didn't taste the same.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that gets at what you were looking for this morning.
Yes, thank you.
The only thing that I have yet to understand exactly is, I've talked to a lot of dairy folks about the milk prices, but what are the factors that lead to that? Is it that's just what the market will bear because people's spending budgets are down, or is it competition from other places, or what is it?
Mr. Chair, and certainly folks from the dairy industry can answer this probably better than I, but the dairy industry is amazingly efficient. When prices go up, they find cows, and they bring a lot of new cow supply into the market to produce more milk. And we saw milk prices pretty high in 06, 07, early 08. And so their production just ramped up. And then basically, boom, when the economy dropped, people, especially cheese, higher-end milk products, even milk itself, they just consume less, and there's just completely oversupply, both nationally and internationally. Mm. The short-term notion of buying down cheese inventories, the other part of the Meet the Need program is also buying out pork and poultry, so actually slaughtering pigs and turkeys to reduce supply. The dairy industry itself has chosen to pay for herd reduction out of its own checkoff money. So part of the debate was whether there should be additional federal dollars to support herd reduction. The challenge that we face in the dairy industry is you may reduce, we've seen it in the past, you reduce herds for a year or two, prices go back up, boom, new cows come online. So the dairy industry itself, both Oregon and Washington producers, are really talking about what they think is a need for a long-term supply management program where there would be herd reduction and then some kind of controls on any future herd ramp-ups. What that would look like and how it would work, I think, is the big challenge, and they're trying to get their head around that, and it's being talked about at the national level, too, and it would have to be a national program. You couldn't just do it in one region of the state.
That raises a question with me, too, because my cousin has 500 head in Wisconsin, and they're all on the bovine growth hormone. So I'm sure that has contributed to overproduction as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman, probably to some extent. I think you're seeing, depending on where you're at in the U.S., movement away from using the growth hormones and not. Some of that is own farmer preferences, some is market-driven. But even if that was not a factor, you would still see the herd numbers go up and down. And obviously, the more efficient you can become and reduce your costs and increase your net income, so the growth hormone would contribute to that.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you. In the milk production, the federal government used to play a pretty heavy hand in buying up surpluses and moving it back and forth. Are they taking less of a role in that? Is that causing some of the
problems? Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, you know, we have a dairy farmer on our board, Bernie Faber, who I think a lot of you have met. I do not understand the national milk system at all, and he starts talking about it, and I mean, my eyes roll back into my head, so I honestly could not tell you what is happening at the federal level in terms of buying up milk and other inventories.
Yeah, because follow-up. Cause, I mean, it used to be cotton and milk were the two things that the government just got fully involved in all the time, and we had a farm in Illinois, a family that did dairy, and it was unbelievable for them. They didn't know, you know, sometimes everything they did went off to the federal government. Other times they were in the marketplace. So I don't, yeah. So
that's Representative, my sense is that's still
happening.
The case in the dairy industry.
Because they usually tried to keep that cost about, I mean, that's an awfully big variation in price. In milk prices. I mean, that was one I thought was pretty common.
Mr. Chair and Representative Roblin, the sad thing is we are seeing suicides among dairy farmers. California, Washington's had one, Wisconsin. It's pretty dire.
Very bleak for them. It really is.
I mean, it's shocking to me.
Another factor, I think, you know, having worked with the little kids, is the medical professions push away from milk for children. That if children develop certain things, milk has become the culprit. And I think a lot of kids aren't drinking milk like they used to. You know, we were all raised to drink milk. And in Wisconsin, of course, we only ate butter.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Let's put it right on time, Nathan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nathan Bueller. I'm the Branding and Marketing Manager with the Oregon Business Development Department, also known under our new name, Business to Oregon. And Brand Oregon is one project that I manage for our agency, and it's one I've asked to tell you a little bit about today. Let me also say that our director, Tim McCabe, really did want to be here today, but he was had a pre-scheduled meeting up in Portland with a business we're trying to help out, so he cannot be down here, but sends his regards. Let me start with some history on the Brand Oregon campaign. It was created in 2004 by Governor Kulongoski to establish an all-encompassing umbrella brand for the state, and to unify state communication and marketing efforts. Really, the goal was to tell Oregon's story, to establish what. Identify what Oregon's brand image was, and then put some limited dollars behind it to help kick it off and tell that story out into the marketplace. This project was created not just around branding Oregon's food products, but really to develop a brand plan for all state outreach. The Departments of Agriculture, Tourism, and Economic Development were especially involved because these are the agencies that are most tasked with marketing the state of Oregon and most involved with economic development within the state. Brand Oregon brought our agencies together to create a branding plan that we can all get in line, tell the same story, and get that consistent and compelling brand messaging out into the marketplace. So since 2004, our agency, Business Oregon, has funded the effort with funding approved by the governor. These funds were used to work with Portland brand consulting firm Wieden & Kennedy to develop what that initial brand plan was, the strategy behind it, and then engage in some marketing activities, including advertising, other promotions, promotional events, etc., to get that brand out into the marketplace. So now that the brand plan was established, initial ad campaigns and other activities had communicated those key messages and gotten the look of Oregon out into the marketplace, we've really moved to integrating the brand ideals into our day-to-day work. For example, Tourism's Oregon Dreamers advertising campaign, their main print advertising campaign right now, was created from the original branding work through Brand Oregon, the concepts, but it's paid for through existing Travel Oregon marketing dollars, and it's actually been the most successful print campaign that they've ever taken on due to response rates and customer surveys. So because it no longer has specific funding, we don't treat Brand Oregon as a specific entity, as a standalone entity, but really as an integrated approach. In terms of the Oregon Business Development Department and what we do, our focus is on retaining Oregon businesses, expanding existing Oregon businesses, and recruiting new businesses into the state. For existing Oregon businesses, including food processors, et cetera, we help with capacity expansion via financing and infrastructure improvements, other general business financing, workforce development issues. We assist with access to foreign markets. We assist the Oregon Department of Agriculture, lean manufacturing consulting, and also investments in research and development and lean manufacturing process improvement, et cetera. With Oregon's integrated global economy, for our agency's work, we often see the greatest marketing activities bring the value there lies outside of state lines to bring new dollars into the state. Specific to food products, in addition to supporting the Oregon Department of Agriculture in creating export opportunities, we also like to leverage the the accolades of Oregon products, the quality. You were just talking about Rogue Creamery's fine blue cheese, certainly the fine wine, the beer that we produce here in Oregon. Those types of things, the more we can do to communicate that these are Oregon products, that they're high-quality products, they're premium products in the marketplace, the more that helps to just get the word Oregon out there. The more we can introduce those products overseas, the more people are familiar with this state, and that brings benefits on many fronts. So often in our business recruitment, we might introduce someone to Oregon's business environment over an Oregon beer, or use that as an icebreaker to really introduce people into the state. We also leverage the sustainability, the innovation, the quality of Oregon cuisine in general. So quality of life matters to companies, and part of the brand Oregon, you know, the efforts of branding the state are really to communicate that out into the world, not just nationally. But let me walk through a handful of some projects that were done under the brand Oregon umbrella, specifically funded with some of those dollars that we had allocated to the brand Oregon program. The original Oregon Seafood campaign that happened in 2005 was the first sizable direct-to-consumer promotion. You may be familiar with it. It was within the state's borders. This involved incorporated outdoor advertising, print advertising, radio advertising, and also some specific events and some point-of-sale promotion at some of our Oregon retailers. The return on this investment, there were some gains in seafood prices, though of course that's difficult to judge whether that's due to increased demand because of the marketing of the product or decrease in supply. But what it did do is certainly bring value and awareness to the Oregon seafood industry and the importance of that industry to Oregon's economy, and communicate the quality of the product to the Oregon consumer. Another project, food specific, that was undertaken was in response to the 2007 December storms. We partnered with the Department of Agriculture on a point of sale signage campaign for that round Dungeness crab to communicate that it's nothing's wrong with the product, it's still high quality, and by purchasing Dungeness crab, you can help the coastal economies recover from the devastating effects of the storm. We did some radio advertising purchase, and we partnered with Entercom Radio. They chipped in a significant amount of airtime in kind to the promotion. Another great example of a partnership is the FoodX trade show that we partner with our friends at Department of Agriculture. They lead this project, and it's the largest food trade show in Asia and located in Japan. Departments of Agriculture, our agency, the Business Development Department, Travel Oregon, Port of Portland, and a handful of private sector companies all chipped in to develop an entire Oregon booth at this event. All these organizations were interested in going to the event for their own purposes, but by pooling all of our money together and then adding some brand Oregon dollars to it, we were really able to have a significant presence, still letting each of those organizations get their specific messages across to achieve their goals, but having much more impact and having everything with a consistent Oregon brand for the entire show. The results of that were great sales leads for our private sector companies, and it's been a really great success story of partnership between our agencies. A couple other things we food related helped fund the launch of Travel Oregon's Oregon Bounty Program, a shoulder season promotion between the high tourism seasons of winter and summer. Tourism was looking to do something in the fall, and with some brand Oregon dollars, we helped to launch that event. It's Travel Oregon's event, and it's been a successful one for them, and they're currently expanding it. It promotes local regional cuisine, local experiences around not just food, but packaging together all sorts of recreation opportunities within different regions of the state, and then promoting those experiences. We've also partnered with the private sector. You mentioned Truett Brothers right here in Salem earlier. They had a fantastic concept. They've been going to the National Restaurant Association show in Chicago every year. to sell their products to buyers from throughout the country. And they had the idea to really sell Oregon cuisine, the brand of Oregon cuisine, and of course use that to help promote their products. We came on board to chip some dollars in towards the effort and help coordinate as well, and also brought several other of their food processing partners in to really bring Oregon to Chicago, to rent an event space, to the decor, the cuisine, everything, bring Oregon to the event. And they've had a lot of success with it because we had limited funding just through the department. We weren't able to provide funds to that effort this year, but I know they are still continuing to do it and seeing some great success, and I'm proud that we're able to help them at the beginning a couple years back. We've also provided some limited support to the Oregon Brewers Guild, particularly around Craft Beer Month in July, to help promote Oregon beers and Oregon product. Really just some point of sale signage, helped coordinate with them on a couple of events. In terms of future planning, the future brand Oregon and what it is right now, like I said, because it doesn't have specific allocated funding, we really treat it as an integrated approach to how and really how we communicate with other partner agencies to all tell the same Oregon story. With only several one-time grants through our own agency's funds, we have not established any long-term projects that are going to require regular financing because it hasn't been in place. We do work closely with partners to identify projects that can leverage the most for the limited dollars we have and generate the highest return. The projects I just walked through are good examples of that, really instances where partners are bringing money and good ideas to the table, and with an investment of some of those brand Oregon funds, we can help bring over the top to make the project happen to generate the highest return. If funds were again allocated towards branding Oregon's products, including food, these are the types of projects that the state could either continue to fund, expand on, or replicate in other areas. But like I said, the Brand Oregon concept was not just food, but really to wrap around the entire state outreach, particularly in the areas of business development, tourism, and our fine food products.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Chair Van Klim. I wanted to ask you if product placement was part of your strategy at all. Have you guys talked about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, we have not engaged in terms of product placement, in movies, television, that kind of thing. Often that's a high-dollar proposition. Like I said, certainly showcasing our products outside of state lines, both nationally and internationally, was a focus, particularly with events like FoodX and such. But no, we have not engaged in any product placement through the entertainment industry or sports, et cetera.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. It is big business, and it's pretty sophisticated outside, but my thought was at least a conversation with the film office about productions here might be a good idea. There might be, if you provide a product, for instance, during production, mm-hmm. you might get it featured. And I'm not talking necessarily about the entertainment side, but training videos, product rollout videos. We've got quite a number of projects, particularly in the Portland area, where that might be at least worth a conversation. For they call them industrials and those kinds of things. I mean, if it's not costing us anything, is my point, then it would be great to have our products featured.
Chair Klim, Representative Gilliam, I'll be happy. I was just chatting with Vince Porter from our film office yesterday. I'll be happy to chat with him again about just that.
Anything else? Yes, sir, Nathan. Yeah, I just wanted folks to sort of hear what the potential was if we could get back to investing in this project. I know this is not a Ways and Means subcommittee, and I'm the only member there, but you know, I think that as you hear the challenges that we hear from Katie and the opportunities from Katie, it was also important to think about, for me at least, to hear what other kinds of things are being done with limited dollars that, if we're going to get serious about economic recovery, might want to invest in some of these initiatives. Okay. Yeah, Representative Roblin.
And I guess what I would say is, you know, the seafood institutes and the stuff that we have in the Astoria and Seaside areas and the stuff that we've done with seafood in Brand, Oregon has been really remarkable, actually, when you consider the values that have gone up. And I know that, like Port Orford, almost all live fish catch and sale in the San Francisco market, they've changed how their community can survive because the price value has gone up so great. And we talked a little bit about that with ag before. But I think Brand, Oregon has made that easier and has helped a lot of these people see the value of having that kind of a program. And, you know, we capitalize on Oregon anyway just because this green issue that we've been doing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And people do, outside of here, have a nostalgic feeling about Oregon, and Oregon products can certainly take advantage. So I appreciate what you're doing, and I especially for the coast, it's been really helpful at times for our people. So thank you.
Representative Roblin, thank you very much. I think certainly our fine quality of our seafood is well known, and the more we can leverage the strength of the industry would be to the state's benefit.
Yeah. I have a question.
Yep, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. One of the interesting things that's happening today are the young people that are venturing out into different kinds of businesses. You know, we have brewmasters who are into craft beers. And is there an involvement of Business Oregon in these small ventures that are going out in a lot of communities?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, small business is absolutely a focus of our agency. Our number one priority is retaining Oregon businesses first, expanding Oregon businesses, and then recruiting new business into the state in that order. And certainly we've seen growth. The craft beer industry, I'm in communication with the Brewers Guild and with our good friends at the Department of Agriculture. We have more breweries per capita in the city of Portland than any other city in the world. I believe that statistic still holds true. And anywhere that we're seeing an industry have a lot of economic impact, we try to help that industry as much as we can through some of our small business financing programs, et cetera. We certainly don't have any business finance programs specifically to craft beer, specifically to any of those, but companies like the ones we're talking about, entrepreneurs getting started in industries like craft beer, we do have resources both through some of our small business partners and also some of our traditional business financing programs.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you
very much.
So, he's actually going to be transferred onto the phone, and both people are here. So
okay, great. Bob's on hold, and Ron's here, right?
Yes.
Ron, do you want to come up? Thank you. Thanks for coming down.
Mr. Gore, are you on the line?
Yep.
Let me try that again. Mr. Gore? Uh-huh.
Katie, could you come up? You're really good at
Mr.
this.
Mr. Gore, yeah. You hang up your phone. That worked last time.
I'd like to get our friends from Washington down and then hang up on them.
Mr. Gore? Are you disconnecting the line in? That was what it took the crisis. Mr. Gore?
There's nothing more pleasurable than watching people struggle with technology.
Mr. Gore?
Why does it make you feel...
Mr. Gore?
Yes, I'm here.
All right.
Sorry about that.
Bob, this is Brian Clem. I'm the chair of our House Ag Committee. We're here. We've got Ron Schultz at down here in Oregon, and we want to thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about our future farming study.
Great. I'll just give a slight intro for the committee. Somewhere along the way, I think probably in the Capital Press, I read about the establishment of the Future Farming Study, was quite thrilled at the prospect and envious, and figured at some point we would be able to hear a little bit about, if not emulate, some of the things you're working on or partner in those. So I thought it was a good opportunity to see if we could do that, and both of these two gentlemen, one on the phone, one in person, were kind enough to be willing to come down and visit with us about what they're working on, and I thought the committee would all enjoy hearing about it. So, Bob, we've got a PowerPoint up on our screen here that do we have, Ron, are you prepared to kind of, yeah, okay, we've got.
I'll click it through there for you,
we've
Bob.
We've got a human body at the space bar, and we're ready to go.
Great. Well, and thanks, Ron, for being there and helping with this presentation.
Sure thing, Bob. Just let me know when you want me to change the slide. I've got the title slide on.
Okay. Well, I want to open briefly by discussing the importance of ag in Washington State and on our dependence on international trade. In recognition of agriculture's importance to Washington State, the 2007 legislature charged the department with conducting the Future of Farming Study. They also supplied $450,000 to conduct this study. I'll share a little about the process we used to engage the industry and generate this report. And the interesting perspective, I think, from where I sit, is that this is a grassroots-generated document, that this is not the Washington State Department of Agriculture's view of the issues, strengths, weaknesses, and opportunities within agriculture. And then I'll describe the five key categories of factors impacting industry competitiveness. If I could have this. The agriculture, a leading industry, the food and agriculture sectors of the economy in Washington generated $42 billion in 2007. This represents about 14% of the state's economy, and on an annual basis is responsible for about 160,000 jobs in Washington State. In 2007, our 34,000 farms sold $8.5 billion in crops and livestock, and this was kind of riding a wave of three consecutive years of records. It was a 23% increase in farm gate value, and as I said, it was third record year in a row. Now, this is just a slide to show, I like to show people, that shows that agriculture is not just an Eastern Washington proposition, that agriculture occurs in all 39 counties in Washington State. Then the next slide is on food processing. What's interesting to note here is that food processing is not always located next to the supply areas of the state. If you'll notice on this slide, King County, our most densely populated county in the state of Washington, is the number one food processing county by far in Washington State. Food processing is a $12 billion a year industry, and we have over 2,000 food processing firms across the state. A little bit about food exports. Can we have the next slide, Ron?
You have it?
Yep, you're good.
So food exports in 2008, ag exports were $14.8 billion. This was another record. It was a 60% increase over the previous year. Agriculture is the second largest export category for the state of Washington, principally behind airplanes. Our leading destinations, I think, are very similar to Oregon's. They're Japan, Canada, Mexico, Philippines, Taiwan, Korea, Indonesia, and China. Top ag exports are wheat, apples, seafood, processed foods, and dairy. Being one of the most trade-dependent states in the nation, we depend on strong yields, high prices, weak international dollars, unfortunate weather events in our competing countries, focuses on trade missions and governor's missions, and that we try and maintain strong trading relationships. And our governor is firmly convinced that this is, if we maintain this position, this is one of the strategies and factors that will help us recover from this recession. So now we get to the future of farming study. As I said earlier, the 2007 legislature directed the Department of Ag basically to identify the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats to agriculture, and to make recommendations to policymakers, both at the state and local levels, and within agency or industry organizations, that will keep farming in Washington competitive, sustainable, and profitable. So the assessment and development of a strategic plan for ag is known as the Future of Farming Study. We interpreted that assignment as a mandate to obtain the views directly from the producers of all sizes, types of production, and similar to Oregon, our strength is in our diversity. We produce over 300 crops and commercially in the state of Washington. Acknowledging there's not always agreement on assessments of the current situation in light of that diversity are the best way for the industry to move forward. However, there was wide agreement on key priorities. So the important part is this is a producer-based report, and is a starting point to expand the discussion on the issues identified in this report. So a little about the process. To get this started, we appointed a 16-member steering committee from all corners of the state and from all different agricultural disciplines. These individuals were nominated by their respective industry groups. We then did about 20 listening and focus group sessions across the state. We had over 300 producers and industry groups participate. We had a convenient online survey that we had over 900 responses from farmers and ranchers, agricultural service providers, agriculture groups, and we had a number of responses members as well. So Ron, got it. Can I have the slide that says top challenges, please?
You've got it.
So the top challenges, and these, once again, are as identified by Washington farmers and ranchers and agribusinesses, processors, academia. The number one challenge facing ag industry in Washington is regulations. Second would be land, and these are ranked in order of input we receive. So regulations, number one, labor, second, land, and I'm sure Ron will be talking about that later, is third. Input costs, and this survey was developed at a time when diesel was over $5 a gallon and fertilizer prices, any oil-based inputs were extremely high. Education and research, and then water. So those are the top challenges. The kind of the categorical recommendations were. Now, this was interesting. The first one, if I can have the next slide, Ron, the first recommendation was to make agriculture a priority. And in the number of discussions that decided what the top priority was, many said we need to keep agriculture as a priority. But after considerable discussion in this cross-section of industry, it said, well, we don't think we are a priority, and we need to make agriculture a priority. Second is to eliminate regulatory barriers. Third, protect agricultural resources. Strengthen support services and harness emerging opportunities. So that is kind of the 30,000-foot level view of the plan. Ron had graciously agreed to deliver executive summaries. Did everybody manage to get one of those?
Yes. Yes, we all have them. Thank you.
Okay, so now the challenge then becomes implementing the plan. So within the plan, it identifies opportunities for legislative consideration, policy changes, development and funding decisions that reflect the interest and input of all stakeholders, The vision, issues, and strategies must continue to be communicated and leveraged. We last did a similar study to this in 1989, so I don't know if this is an every two-decade event, but the differences are and were that in 1989, this was a look at the industry as generated by the Department of Agriculture. It was very well received. It had a lot of integrity, but it had a very short shelf life. That it was published, it was leveraged for maybe one legislative session or two, and then rapidly became shelf art. So our challenge from here on out, and it is a considerable challenge in these times of diminishing resources in state government and state agencies, is to keep this plan alive. So it must stay relevant and available to ag sectors. It is being used not just by the Department of Agriculture, but all throughout the industry in agricultural associations and organizations, by local governments, and even at the federal level. So we need to stay, keep it relevant and keep it alive. And it's going to be a challenge without any resources. So what we are asking the industry to do about 3 weeks from now is we're pulling them together and say, where do we take this from here? It is the general consensus and a great deal of enthusiasm about keeping this plan alive. From my perspective, what was really valuable is you're bringing 300 diverse commodity groups together and getting them to talk about common issues, overarching issues affecting agriculture. So it provides for a more collaborative environment to synthesize efforts around these challenges and opportunities. So I'd be happy to answer questions. I know you just got the executive summary. There is a website that contains the full report with a number of appendices that goes into depth on all of the issues, provides folks a 360-degree look into what all the various complications are around these issues. So it's a great educational document as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. We do have some questions. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gore.
Yes.
Have you set up specific matrix in your implementation plan that will tell you what you're trying to accomplish? And then have you set up a timeline for evaluating whether you are achieving those objectives or whether you need to redirect your efforts?
I guess the answer would be we have not. That is what we hope to attempt to establish, those timelines and those issues that the industry wants to move forward on by convening and institutionalize an annual meeting, perhaps, of industry leaders from all these commodity groups. I know that we work closely with the Office of Farmland Preservation on a lot of the land issues, and they have taken up a number of the recommendations around land, land disappearance and land use, and we're working, we have a seat on their task force. So we are, I think the important thing for us is that this generates some synergy and makes folks generally aware of where the lead is on working in these issues. So no, in answer to your question, we have not done that. The funding we received and then the budget cuts that we've got now, it's going to have to be principally owned by the agricultural industry from here on out, with us facilitating and having a seat at the table and leading to the extent we can.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
And my question has to do with, you listed as the top priority regulation or hindrance. And did they identify what regulations? Are they federal? Are they state? Are they a combination? I mean, is there a plan on how to go about taking away some regulations or changing them to make it work better for the agricultural industry? Because I think we looked at the same thing in this state and regulations popped up. So my issue is, are there federal ones whereas regionally we can attack things and so on and so forth?
Yes, Representative, good question. There were specific recommendations. in answer to your question, were there some regulations that caused more problems than others? We didn't drill down into that level of detail and didn't have time or resources in the study. The recommendation was to establish a blue ribbon panel to evaluate the impact of regulations on egg production. And other recommendations were that the Department of Agriculture should have, for lack of a better term, an agricultural ombudsman position to help producers understand what regulations that they need to be in compliance with, have them navigate that maze between, you know, environmental regulations, National Marine Fisheries Service, EPA, agriculture, DNR, Department of Natural Resources, Fish and Wildlife. So there's, unless you're a large agricultural operation, you probably don't even know all the regulations that you should be in compliance with. So there's the overlapping regulations, there's the multiple entities with jurisdiction. There was concern about regulations not being scaled or scoped. If you're a farmer with 10 acres, you're under the same regulatory responsibility as somebody that's farming 5,000 acres. So it was more about they wanted one place to go, that whether they wanted to establish an agricultural business or a farm in Washington, or if they're an existing farm or ranch in Washington, they wanted one place to go that could help them understand all of the regulations that they need to be in compliance with and provide technical assistance. So that was kind of the two key recommendations that came out of regulations.
Thank you.
And are we still working on the Blue Ribbon Panel establishment?
Yeah, it's still a work in progress, Representative, and that we'll find out how much interest there still is in that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we've got a supplemental budget session that starts after the first of the year, and money, there's going to be a lot of competitions for any money, so we'll see what funding mechanism might be used.
Yep.
Establish that program in the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a lot different than here. I don't think there's going to be any competition down here for money.
No money.
Yeah, it's hard to compete for nothing. Representative Van Erman.
Well, I would just like to share an observation that having been a city commissioner in Oregon City, I don't know how many downtown plans we had. And they have, as you say, they became shelf art. And I would just like to support your attempt to sort of institutionalize some of these processes, because this is what often happens to studies. They do become shelf art. And I think we all want to have something that begins to continue to address these issues we're facing.
Yes, I think it's extremely important as well. And if we can look to the past and learn from it, that's one lesson that we should learn very well and not replicate what we've done in the past. And as diverse as the industries are in both Washington and Oregon, the ag industries, to get them to coalesce and synthesize around issues is very difficult to do. And I think this forum can largely accomplish that if we can institutionalize it.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. We're going to have Ron talk a little bit about his office as well. I'm highly considering tearing the page out, scratching out Washington, putting Oregon, and hanging it on my door. I hope there's no copyright issues. If there are, you can find me later. Those are some nice-looking pairs, too. And, again, there's a Washington on the bin next to him. I may have to edit that with Photoshop and put in Hood River. But thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us.
My pleasure. And you might want to Photoshop that picture on the back of the front page.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Our director of ag is coming to chime in, too, about my theft.
Good morning, Deputy Director Gore. This is Katie Koba.
Good morning, Katie.
It's good to hear your report. I just wanted to echo what the chair said. You could easily scratch out Washington and put Oregon, and it would mean the exact same thing. We're hoping that you can continue your work so we can continue just to take all of your results and implement them here. But one of the things I did want to mention is the Oregon and Washington Departments of Agriculture work very, very closely together. And I would say over the course of the last few years, we've really made a focused effort to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We participated in a Western States trade mission to China a year and a half ago, which was actually led by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And then our two states, the new director in Washington, Director Newhouse, Deputy Director Gore, myself, and contingents from Oregon and Washington will be going to Taiwan, the Philippines, and China in November. So our focus on that mission is potatoes, Oregon and Washington potatoes, and some work that we're doing there. But I think it's really important to note the similarity amongst our two states is just kind of uncanny. And we think there's a lot that can be done by working together. And so we're doing that on the marketing side as well as on the regulatory side. Our two state departments of ag, along with the Department of Idaho Ag Department, our departments of environmental quality get together twice a year with EPA to talk about regulations, and it's one forum where we express our concerns and try to work through some of the issues that we're facing. So there is a lot of opportunity, especially, I think, when we partner together and can talk about regional work that would benefit the industry. So I wanted to make sure the committee knew that, but as well, again, just thank the Washington Department of Agriculture for being such a strong partner for us.
Thanks, Katie, and I would echo those comments. It's not only important for our agriculture industry to work together, but I think and have appreciated the relationship and collaboration that we've had principally between our two states in the last 3 to 4 years.
Representative Roblin.
I just appreciate the fact that Washington, having been a part of the Oregon Territory, is so much like us. and I grew up in the Oregon Territory in Port Angeles, Washington, so I have a connection there as well. But it is always nice to have the body coming back together as part of the Oregon Territories again.
Mm-hmm. Is this where I chime in and say I had Head Start programs in Klickitat and Skamania County?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, great. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Ron.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Ron Schultz, Policy Director for the Washington State Conservation Commission, and it's my pleasure to be here this morning to talk to you about our Office of Farmland Preservation and the work that the office is doing. First, a little history about the Office of Farmland Preservation, and you should have a copy of our 2008 report for the office, and I'll be describing some elements of that. We have extra copies, too, for folks, I think, some are left in the audience. A little history about our Office of Farmland Preservation. The office is a program located within our Washington State Conservation Commission, and our commission, different from Oregon in that we're an independent state agency. We're separate from the Department of Agriculture. We're not a part of the department. We're an independent agency, and we work with our 47 conservation districts around the state. This year, the commission is celebrating our 70th anniversary of providing service to farmers in Washington. OFP is funded for two FTEs and approximately $250,000, but with budget cuts that we've had to reduce the funding, and we've left one of the FTE positions vacant, doing what we can with one and relying on other staff and stealing other staff from agencies where we can to help us out. Why an Office of Farmland Preservation? Well, between 1997 and 07, we've lost over 800,000 acres of farmland in Washington State. We've lost 4,000 cropland farms in the state, and of those, 1,000 were family farms. And in your in the report, you have a color map of the state of Washington that we put together with the Federal National Agricultural Statistics. What I find interesting about this map is that if you look at the bar, you'll see where in our state the small farms are predominantly located. And there is a misconception, I think, that, you know, eastern Washington has all the big farms because you see the big fields, and western Washington doesn't have any farms. Well, actually, western Washington has quite a few farms, and they're smaller farms. And eastern Washington, although we do have large wheat fields, we do have quite a large number of smaller acreage farms. And one of the reasons I'd like to try to develop the map over time so we can show what sizes of farms we've lost over time And I think this is helpful because as we think about agricultural policy, I always like to think of it overgeneralized in three buckets of small, medium, and large. I get into debates with other ag policy folks in the state about, do I mean small, medium, large acreage? Do I mean production value? What do I mean? But if you think of it in that way, then you can see how in each bucket there are different policy needs for each one. So a large operation may have issues around immigration that perhaps a smaller acreage operation won't have, but a smaller operation may have issues that are different from a larger, and this allows you to segregate a little bit and deal with those issues that affect those specific farmers by their needs. And then also over 2,000 farms in Washington saw a reduction in family wage income, and you saw those statistics, these parallel statistics for Oregon. The bill creating the Office of Farmland Preservation passed in 2007 with legislative findings that maintaining capacity to provide adequate food and fiber is essential to our state. Population growth is increasing competition for land. That once productive agricultural areas are overtaken and converted to non-agricultural uses. Other ag areas in the state have diminished, that they're close to losing the landmass necessary to become economically viable. This gets at the concept of maintaining a sufficient land base in areas of the state so that you and production in those areas so that you can have the infrastructure to support the agricultural operations, because once that diminishes, you can start losing the feed stores, the supply stores, and pretty soon, especially for smaller operations, agriculture just isn't viable. You heard a little bit about processing concerns in Oregon. We have the same problem in Washington, where beef producers are having trouble with processing facilities, and so we're trying to find some solutions there to keep that infrastructure there. And this is kind of the next one is reflective of Bob Gore's comments. It's imperative that we establish a state-level focus attention to take away to take action needed to retain ag land. We need to have that focus on agricultural lands and maintaining those lands, but also to ensure that there's opportunities for future generations to work those lands. The office's power and duties include, first, to provide an analysis of the factors that led to past declines in the amount of available land in Washington, including what are the pressures to convert to non-agricultural uses, the loss of processing plants and markets, loss of competitive advantage, urban sprawl, and conversion to recreation or other uses. We're also to develop model programs and tools to retrain ag land and ag production with guidance from our Farmland Preservation Task Force that I'll talk about in a moment. We're to provide technical assistance to local governments to develop programs and mechanisms to retain ag lands.
As part one question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Nolan.
Is there a parallel office that focuses on small woodlot operators or timberland as well? I would imagine you face the same kinds of pressure there.
We included timberland in our analysis
so
for
your
farmland
office
preservation.
Addresses both
yes.
crops and timber.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks.
For this project for technical assistance to localities, we had a grant program, eight grants of $25,000 that we gave to eight counties on a competitive basis to develop agricultural strategic plans within their counties. A grants process, this is a grants program that I referred to, and then develop a clearinghouse for incentive programs that would be available to landowners to assist them to implement conservation easements and other projects on their lands. A farm transition program, this is a key component for the Office of Farmland Preservation. Our legislation required that we provide analysis and recommendations and develop and implement a farm transition program that would assist in the preparation of business plans for transition of business interests, assist existing properties and ag operations to interested buyers, and research and assistance. What we're thinking on a farm transition program is we're thinking of, if you think of what happens in a transaction or a farm transition, you have obviously the landowner who's working the land, you have those who potentially may want to get into agriculture, and in the middle you have the transaction facilitators, the real estate brokers, the bankers, the lawyers, And we're trying to develop a program that'll provide information to each of those three areas that is information that they will need. So do we have the people who are interested in getting into agriculture? And a comment was made earlier about the young people getting into businesses. There are quite a few young people today that are interested in getting into agriculture, particularly around organics and sustainable crops production. You have an aging population in agriculture that is looking to retire. If they can sell the property to someone who wants to farm it, they'd do that because they would most likely would like to see it continue in farming operations. But if the price is right, they'll sell it to a Walmart and have it paved over. So what we want to do is have that opportunity for a new producer, a new farmer to come in. And so for the transaction in the middle, we're looking at some programs to work with the professional communities. For example, we've been talking with the legal community. I'm an attorney myself. I've been working with the legal community to develop continuing legal education courses around farm transition opportunities so that attorneys in rural communities understand what those opportunities are. Our Farmland Preservation Task Force is a 16-member task force that included six farmer representatives from six regions in the state. At least one was a commercial livestock producer. I liked this one. At least two had to be under the age of 45, which was kind of an interesting. I've never really seen that kind of a requirement from the legislature. But the idea was we need to get these younger producers in the mix and have them discussing what the opportunities are. And those six were appointed by the governor. We also included a representative of the Conservation Commission, Department of Agriculture. We also had representatives from our Association of Conservation Districts from the eastern side of the state and the western side of the state. We also had representation from our state legislature, from the governor's office, and from one representative of all the conservation districts in the state. The task force considered issues of water, which included competing uses for water, conservation of water, and relinquishment of water rights, easements, transfer of development rights, and purchase of development rights. We also looked at mapping and using mapping technology and GIS technology to see if we could identify properties at risk of conversion. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We looked at how our state manages lands, particularly for weed control. We looked at our state's open space tax and how that's working for agriculture. We also looked at agriculture permitting and right-to-farm regulation, right-to-farm statutes that each county has, as well as regulations. And we looked at marketing. These issues were identified by our task force after they traveled around the state. And in the report you'll find in the appendix, we tried to capture all of the meetings. I've always hated it being a member of a task force or trying to follow a task force, and they travel and we do field trips. But then you never hear anything more about it. So what we tried to do is capture in our report what we saw, who we talked to, what we learned on our field trips and each of the meetings. And you can read through there. And they were really interesting. I think one of the lessons we learned as we traveled around was the farmers that were most successful were the farmers that were most diversified in their production and their marketing. A good example of that is Dickey Farms in Bingen in the Columbia Gorge. And he has several acres that he farms, but they're in the city limits. The parcels are in the city limits, and he has a stand. Many of you may have been there. But he also sells his product into Portland. And he said that the stand that he has, it started out as a fruit stand, but it grows a little bit. He sells a little bit more than just fruit now, unless he has locally grown pineapples. But he sells a little bit more. But he does get people coming from the Portland, Vancouver area on weekends out to his stand. And the store actually provides enough income that he can continue to do row crops on lots that are in the city limits that otherwise might be converted. So that's an example of some diversification. Farmers who, a rancher in North Central Washington, who has roughly 600 head of cattle, was having trouble with a Tyson slaughterhouse because he took his herd there as he was supposed to, and Tyson said, well, we're full up right now for the next couple months with Canadian beef. You're going to have to hold your beef for 6 months. Well, he had that added expense to do that. Well, he just had the one crop and the one strategy, so he didn't have that diversification. Some highlights in our report. As I mentioned, we distributed $200,000 in grants to eight counties in the state. It looks like we'll be able to do another round of eight grants of $25,000 each to counties. Each of the counties, as part of the grant, were to develop, work with folks in the local community and develop agriculture strategic plans for their county. What are their goals? What are their objectives for agriculture within the county? And then that strategic plan would be used at various opportunities in the state to help guide other decisions. So, for example, economic development opportunities or land use planning by the county, it would help guide that. We've had problems with conflict in economic development in rural counties where an example was our Port of Tacoma was looking to expand and do an off-site distribution facility of around 1,000 acres where they would take containers right off the ships, put them right on trains, take them to a distribution facility where they would be distributed. The first 1,000 acres they looked at were farmland. And the local community said, we don't like that. So they said, well, if you don't like this, here are three other properties, and they happen to be three other farms. Unfortunately for the port, one of the farms that they identified was the farm of the chair of our Conservation Commission, and he learned about it in the newspaper. So we're now working with our state's Economic Development Council to try to not have those kind of conflicts in the future. But having a local agriculture strategic plan will help with that. I mentioned we traveled to six regions in the state. We funded a farm transition conference in Skagit County to bring landowners together. We also, I think part of that program, we used a program that was developed at OSU on farm transition. I know that our Washington Farm and Forestry Association has used it. I've participated in those, and it was really helpful for landowners to really learn about transition. As if you haven't seen that, I really recommend it to you. We have an electronic version of a farmland preservation newsletter that we distribute to over 2,000 people. I think the email list is up to 2,500 now, whether they want it or not. We send it to them. I hope it's not considered spam, but it seems to be getting well received. And our idea there is to try to create that focal point for farmland preservation in the state. We have a website that I'll provide more information for you later that we developed last year, and we're partnering with the University of Washington on land use models on risk of conversion. This is our mapping project. The University of Washington School of Forestry was doing this for forest lands in the state, and they were mapping where forest lands in the state are at risk of conversion. And they developed a database that is literally parcel by parcel in every county of the state of what the land use type is and where the forests are in Washington. And then comparing that with the land use designations so they could see where growth trends are to say, where's the risk of conversion for timberlands? So we're contracting with the University of Washington to develop those maps in cooperation with our State Department of Agriculture has crop maps where they literally do drive-bys of parcels in the state and identify what crops are growing on what parcels, actually growing on what parcels or what land is fallow. So we can overlay that with the UW state map parcel by parcel, overlay that with our various county land use plans and growth projections, and we can identify those parcels of farmland that, and forest lands that are at risk of conversion. Then we can target outreach to those landowners to say, are you enrolled in open space tax benefits so that you're getting the benefits of an open space tax and reducing your property taxes? Are you familiar with conservation easements? Are you familiar with other incentive programs? And using our conservation districts to do the outreach to landowners so they're familiar with that if they're at risk of conversion. And finally, we developed an open space tax report that had some policy recommendations on how we could improve the use of our agriculture and open space property tax reduction. That could be pretty significant. I know my dad on his farm has agriculture open space, and it reduces his property taxes by 80%. Our plan for 2009, we continued to work on the task force recommendations, questions about future of farming and how to implement. We have the same philosophy. We don't like reports to be shelf art. So we're tracking very carefully each of the recommendations and we're continuing to work with our task force and report to them on how we're doing in implementing their recommendations. We're going to enhance and develop a clearinghouse that's web accessible for landowners on incentive programs that are available for landowners. We're going to continue, as I mentioned, to develop our farm transition program. The risk of conversion maps that I mentioned, we're going to continue to develop those. We're also working on a suite of indicators for farmland preservation, and you have those in your packet. And the major categories for the indicators are the same categories that are in the Future of Farming report. And these indicators are to measure how we're doing on various aspects of farmland preservation. And some of these indicators we took from a report out of the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies on Planting Prosperity and Harvesting Health, Trade-Offs and Sustainability in Oregon, Washington Regional Food System, if you haven't seen that. We took some of the indicators from that report, indicators from other sources. Our task force worked on the indicators and then came to this suite, which they are recommending to our State Conservation Commission for their approval, which the commission will review and likely approve at their December meeting. But this is a good way for us to try to start looking and tracking the different aspects of farmland preservation in the state and see how we're doing. Again, we're going to continue to assist counties with comprehensive plans. Each county in our state is required to plan. Each county is also required in Washington to designate agricultural lands of long-term commercial significance and timberlands of long-term commercial significance. And we work with various counties in helping them do that for farmland preservation. And we'll continue the farmland preservation newsletter. We'll also continue to work with other agricultural groups in the state on promoting. What we're also looking at is, particularly in the King County, Seattle metropolitan region, are working with other groups such as TILF and sustainable and organic groups to try to get them better organized as part of a marketing approach. There's a growing demand in that area. So what we want to do is try to make provide information to farmers around the state so that they understand those connections that are available in the larger metropolitan areas. This touches a little bit on the marketing approach. One concept is to use the internet more efficiently to help us do that so that a farmer could go online and describe what crops he would have available, and then a user, whether a grocery store or a restaurant, would go online and say, here's what I need, and they would select it from the farmer, and then through the internet they can make those connections and we distribute the product to the retailer. There's our OFP webpage and the webpage address. Encourage you to, if you're surfing the internet sometime, to check that out as a resource. And my boss dared me to put the UW logo on there.
Somebody over here
that may
it.
Be permissible.
What do you win?
He's a hardcore cougar, so
a lot of cougars.
USC.
Had
a good weekend a couple of weeks.
Okay. Well, that was very helpful. Any questions for him?
Yeah, mostly just a comment because I grew up. I am a Husky, so I undergraduate. I grew up in Port Angeles, and my wife's from Sequim, and it's been sad to watch what happened in the Dungeness Valley in Sequim. If it hadn't been for lavender, we probably would have lost the other farming areas. But the mint that used to be grown—I mean, there were so many agricultural activities in that Dungeness Valley, and most of them are now under pavement. So I'm happy to see this happening.
Yes, the peninsula area of Washington and the Sequim area has been very interesting in terms of growth. They've put in quite a few box stores.
Yes,
up there, and there was a debate between the city and the county. In a previous life, I was policy advisor to Governor Gary Locke, and I worked agriculture as well as land use issues. And I went up and talked to the county, and they said, "Well, we're having issues with the city of Port Angeles." And they said, well, I'm going to go talk to the mayor and the council after I meet with you. And they said, oh, well, you tell them these things. I said, okay. So I go to the city and the mayor, and they said, well, you go tell the county commissioners this. They wouldn't even speak to each other. So I was running back and forth literally across the street. And because of that, you had these box stores go in on farmland, and they went in without any infrastructure. So you had a Costco and a Safeway went in on septics.
Yep.
And now they're having trouble with groundwater because the city of Port Angeles wouldn't supply the infrastructure to those stores because they didn't want to pay for it if they were outside the city limits. So those are the kind of disputes that we have that again, makes agricultural land more favorable to development. One problem that we're having in the Skagit Valley, where most of our tulips are grown, is our Department of Transportation is looking at agricultural lands as a place to do wetland mitigation for agricultural products, and that's where most of our wetland mitigation banks are going in. Is on agricultural land because it's cheap. You typically have the hydrology, and so they're going in and converting agricultural lands into mitigation banks.
Yeah, and that Costco eventually couldn't sustain itself, so they moved and built a new Costco in another location. So it's pretty remarkable. And there's a big, if anybody wants a cheap piece of industrial property with a septic system, it exists there.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you. As you've done these studies, and I know Oregon's done studies, looking at what puts farmland at risk, I guess I would be surprised if you're finding anything new or different. over, you know, 20 years ago, or and if you have, you know, it'd be great to know. I would just guess that maybe the pressure shift a little bit, but they're all kind of there and the same. And why sometimes do we do all these studies if we know what the answers are?
That's a good point. I think that although we might not be seeing things new or different, what I'm hoping is that the difference will be we're going to do something about them this time. For example, I should mention that on regulations, because Bob has mentioned that as well, and it was an issue that your director mentioned, what we're thinking in terms of regulations is a study where we will take 6 to 8 actual farms, if there's farmers willing, and we do have some that are willing, or hypothetical farms, to look at, to get some more specific about what are the regulations that are actually affecting farms. Our Washington Farm Bureau has a list of regulations affecting farms, and it goes on for pages. But some of those regulations don't affect all farms. Some of them, like FRFRA, the pesticide regulations, if you're following label instructions, then you're following the regulation. Is that really a burden? But there are other aspects of regulations that could be very burdensome for some farmers, such as labor and industries, worker regulations, or Department of Revenue paperwork regulations. And for some farms, you might have buffer requirements that are restrictive for farms. Other farms, maybe they don't have salmon habitat, so it's not an issue. But what is it about the regulations that are a burden? And let's deal with those specific aspects. So if it's a paperwork problem, let's deal with those regulations. If the regulation is needed, but the paperwork is burdensome, how do we deal with the paperwork so that we can improve that? So we're trying to get more specific about what it is about regulations so that we don't get into the fight with other stakeholder groups about why we have, for example, salmon buffer protections, but instead how do we find a way to make it so they're not burdensome to the landowner so they can stay in production while at the same time meeting the resource objective.
Just a follow-up comment. And that's good, because to me that seems to be where we should be going, is focusing really on what we can do about all those factors and not repeating the studies to determine that the factors really haven't changed. So.
Representative Roblin, and then.
I just want to follow up on the mitigation, because that's the one thing that I think has been a big difference with regard to the impacts on losing farmland. And mitigation sites, I would love to read what you found on that, because I think that's happening in Oregon as well, because I haven't seen a site in a mitigation plan that wasn't farmland or close. I mean, we're taking out dikes, we're filling in, and we're doing a lot of stuff, and every one of those has been a farm in our area, and they're always fine. The only difference would be one was a golf course. So,
just because you got a golf course.
but I mean, it's open space. I mean, it's they're not taking out houses and other things that are in floodplains that probably shouldn't have been there in the first place, and using those, they're taking the easier site, which is the farmland.
Yeah, one of the things that we're working on at the commission, we were given some funding by the legislature to do a study on conservation markets, an opportunity for conservation markets on farm and forest lands in the state, and then to do some pilot projects on those. Then we had the budget cuts. We worked our budget so that we had enough money to complete the study. Our thinking was, let's do a study of what the opportunity is for farmers and forest landowners for conservation markets in the state, so that study would be done, so that then when more funding would become available, we could do some pilot projects. And we're looking at markets. The Willamette Partnership is one that has done this quite a bit. And so we've identified some of those. But what we're trying to do is shift the conversation on mitigation, not to one of acquisition of farm property to put a mitigation site on, but how do you work with a farmer to create additional economic opportunity through conservation markets and mitigation markets, but that the farmer will do it in a way that they can maintain production. Some of the farmers, when they've talked about this, have said, you know how farmers are, if you ask us to produce something, we tend to overproduce. And so if we can create an economic opportunity, can they overproduce some of the mitigation that we need, but doing it in a way where they're retaining the land and doing it in a way that works for them?
Yeah, that's good.
Representative Winger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, you'd mentioned 800,000 acres lost. It looked like over a 10-year period. How are you defining lost? Are you just a survey?
Out of production.
Okay, so it's no longer farmland production. What's the total farm acreage in Washington? So, I mean,
I remember right, the production acreage was 14 million acres.
And then do you do any kind of a breakdown of that 800,000 as to what it ended up becoming? I mean, it went out of production as farmland, but, you know, did it become a Costco? Did it become a wetland? I mean, what?
That's a little bit harder to do. We'd like to get there, and maybe with our GIS data that we're collecting with the University of Washington for land at risk of conversion, we might be able to compare that with land use maps at the local level to identify what they're converting to. But the NASS data just tells you what was in production in previous years and how much less is in production today. So you'd have to get more specific in terms of other data to try to do that. It's really hard. It's kind of hard to do.
Yeah. My only point being that just knowing that land in the state, 800,000 of it converted from one thing to another, really doesn't tell us whether that's a problem or not. I mean, what did it become? And was that, you know, based on whether it's a wetland or a Costco, or, I mean, the community may want one or the other, and that might be a benefit, and they may perceive that as more of a benefit than what it was, which was farmland.
That's true.
And before it was farmland, it, you know, it was wild, and somebody made a decision that farmland was a better use for it. So I think until we understand what the, you know, when you talk about lost, it was really what was really lost, and then, of course, what was gained.
What was gained, right.
And, you know, what does the community want?
That's a good point. We were on a tour in one county where they were talking about, we were looking at some farmland that had recently been sold and was going to be converted to a box store, and they were lamenting the loss of the farmland, the group we were in, and I said, but I hear it's going to be a Whole Foods market, so it's all good. you know, that gets to the community values that you're talking about. One of the challenges that we have in marketing is making the connection between the buyer and the farmers, that they should be selecting the local product that might be a little more expensive, and what are those other values? What are the community values that you're supporting by purchasing the local product in terms of keeping the farmers on those lands? Especially in today's economy, many people are saying, I'm going to buy my produce at Walmart because I have a family and I can't afford to buy it elsewhere where it's more expensive to be for local production. So it's how do we convince people to engage more at that level for these other values that they're interested in, retaining local farms, in retaining the local rural character, and keeping people in agriculture. And that's a real challenge that I'm sure the folks that here in Oregon are in the marketing aspects of it are also experiencing those kinds of challenges.
I guess I would just add one last thought, which is just making a statement that you want to preserve farms. You know, ultimately, something has to be, I mean, farming is an economic activity.
Right.
And if it's not viable, just wanting to preserve that people keep doing that is not really a goal, because if I'm the farmer and I'm losing money just because you want me to keep farming, really, that is not convincing to me. Or, you know, perhaps my children have decided there's some other economic activity they want to engage in. So, I mean, I think the question is, you know, what does the community want? And it may be wetlands, you know. I mean, there may be within a county that they much prefer to see wetlands than farmland. And who makes that decision? And I guess I'm just stuck on this idea of, you know, this. We just have to preserve farmland. I mean, I'm not sure that I agree with that. It just depends on, you know, what the community's interests are. And, again, farmland was not the original use of that land.
Right.
So it's all about the time.
Right.
And what people at the time think is the best use. And it differs from community to community. I mean, you know, in a third world country, you know, the conversation's different than here, where a Whole Foods market might be the conversation, or wetlands mitigation. And
you raise a really good point. We actually had consciously addressed that, because there are a number of groups, as you have in Oregon, that are interested in land preservation for land preservation's sake. And the mission statement from the task force and our mission, as you can see in the list of projects that we're working on, is economically viable farmland. And that's why we talk about marketing. That's why we talk about these different aspects of agriculture, to make sure that the farmer remains economically viable. Because you're right. If the farmer can't make money growing lettuce, they can't make money growing lettuce. And the economics are going to drive them to do other things. Who makes those decisions? In Washington, with our Growth Management Act, the local communities make those decisions. And our projects are not regulatory in the sense that we're not advocating zoning, like British Columbia, who has a very, very strict agricultural land use code for agricultural activities. And instead, we promote incentive-based opportunities like conservation easements and other market-based opportunities to provide income. So I don't want to create a misimpression that we're all just about farmland preservation, because we are very much part of preserving farmland and also making it economically viable to be in farm production.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Van Orman.
I'll try to be brief.
Get our extension.
Yeah, first. I'll try to be brief. A couple of comments first. One, having survived traumatic sewer experiences in the city of Oregon City and now experiencing a third one in Hood River, I am determined that if you want to do anything about land, let's talk about sewer. We cannot continue to keep dumping septic systems. So then we also have a gorge-grown food network in Hood River County. So we're really working on promoting our gorge growers. But my real question is about NAFTA. What effect has NAFTA had on farms? And are you experiencing that? You know, is it helping or hurting? Have you noticed anything?
I'll look to your director
for Katie as well.
For Oregon, we didn't look at that subject. There were certain issues for OFP that we aren't looking at and leaving to Department of Agriculture and the future of farming. So NAFTA, trade issues, immigration issues, those we're all leaving to Department of Agriculture. And we're focusing more on the ground. What I've heard in our last task force meeting was up in Okanagan near the Canadian border, and they have a lot of issues up there. As I mentioned, for example, the Tyson meat processing, where the meat processor, the larger processors, will get Canadian beef and process that, which creates a disadvantage for opportunities for Washington beef. So other than that, we haven't really looked into that issue. I'm sure others at our Department of Agriculture have.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you gotten involved with examining generational transfer of farms and estate tax problems? Or
Our task force just this year asked us to look into that, the estate tax and its implications on transfers, whether that's premature transfers or transfers after death, and what the effect is. We have anecdotal evidence, as I'm sure you've heard, stories of folks who acquire land through an inheritance and because of the estate tax are forced to sell. Mm-hmm. Part of that, we're looking at other solutions such as education of landowners about what are some of the legal opportunities for them to better secure their property for future generations if that's their objective.
Okay, thank you very much for traveling down here and sharing your report with us. And please thank Bob again when you see him first.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My son's business.
Okay. Scott, you want to come on up? Scott's been kind enough to come and talk to us about extension a little bit. We had originally scheduled to meet our new agriculture dean at Oregon State, and he ended up having a pre-existing commitment that we figured out. And so Scott's pinch-hitting on other topics of great import to ag in our state, and we're happy to have you.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Scott Reed. I serve at Oregon State University as what we call Vice Provost for Outreach and Engagement and Director of the OSU Extension Service. Sincere thanks for your invitation to provide an update on extension that is, as you probably know, largely focused on agriculture. About 40% of the extension budget goes into the extension agricultural program. I've declared myself PowerPoint free this morning, which is unusual for a professor. However, I am providing a copy of my talking points from which I'll open with a few highlights. As I'm sure you know, the Extension Service is one of three what we call statewide public services located at Oregon State University. The other two are the Agricultural Experiment Station and the Forest Research Laboratory. The missions are highly integrated in order to develop and apply new knowledge that addresses economic, social, environmental welfare of Oregon citizens, the three pillars of sustainability. We like to say the state is our campus, with offices and faculty in every county in Oregon, and citizens are our students. The relationship to counties and other local partners is absolutely key to the Extension Service's ability to do our job. These facilities around the state are more than offices. They really are a high-speed interconnected network of learning laboratories. Citizens in 19 counties have passed local tax service districts that ensures permanent availability of extension programs in those counties. I believe that more are on the way. And among my concerns is that as we back out state funds from the Extension Service, we risk breaking the citizens' promise of local support in these counties that are increasingly passing the local tax service districts. Now, the state's investment in extension works hard. You know, our faculty across the state magnified and expanded their work in the last year, 2008, through more than 300 grants and contracts that brought an additional $23 million to extension work. On an annual basis, that's about the amount of the state's appropriation. So put a state dollar in and we'll double it with grants and contracts that our faculty go out and find to complement their work. The levering of human capacity is equally impressive. Our some 200 or so statewide extension faculty support an average of about 90 trained volunteers each. That brings the total to almost 9,000, each of whom extends our reach even farther. You'll recognize some familiar names of our trained volunteer programs like Master Gardeners, 4-H program leaders, Master Woodland Managers, Master Watershed Stewards, and the newest trained volunteer program we're calling Climate Masters, that helps people understand and change their carbon footprint in order to contribute to things like global climate change. Now, these volunteers reported that they reached 1.7 million people in the last year, in addition to our faculty's own teaching accomplishments, together reaching 2.3 million students, citizen students, engaged in a design learning experience from the OSU Extension Service. Not bad for a state with 3.8 million population. The volunteers themselves, while they typically underreport their activities, told us that they gave us nearly a million hours of service in 2008, the equivalent of 475 full-time equivalents. I love telling the university's president, for every extension faculty member he allows us to hire, I can produce the equivalent of two full-time volunteers helping to do the same work. Finally, OSU Publishing, our Extension Publishing Office, has an online catalog of about 1,500 educational publications. In the last year, the webpage received another 2.6 million visits in order to download and obtain information in that way. Now, I want to share some impacts of the reduced biennial budgets in the current biennium. The numbers are a $4.7 million reduction for extension in the biennium. That's about 10 or 11%. That is after relaxing what would have been an additional $0.8 million through the governor's line item veto of the higher ed appropriations bill. We're being very watchful, as I'm sure you are, of the January referendum that has the ability to reduce an additional 5 to 6%, or about $2 million more in the Extension Service, if the reductions are equally spread across state agencies. And, of course, the uncertainty about state revenues and the use of furloughs of the faculty and staff workforce and how they will apply to budget circumstances. So here's what's happening in the Extension Service. Based upon the resources that we know are available to us, we believe that seven counties will lose 4-H faculty, that we will not be able to provide financial literacy training, particularly in these troubled financial times for Oregon citizens. We have critical research and extension vacancies in our Hood River facility addressing plant pathology, post-harvest handling information. Until recently, we had a Lane County Extension Forestry position and forestry FTE reductions on the South Coast. We have had to eliminate a North Coast position that focuses on fisheries bycatch in the lower Columbia River. In agriculture extension alone, we have been reduced a little more than seven full-time equivalents in areas including insect identification services, rangelands, tree fruits, weed and seed management, dairy water quality, and other positions supporting Oregon agriculture. A current example bearing down on us, and had our new Dean of Agriculture and Director of the Experiment Station, Sunny Ramaswamy, been able to be here. He's an entomologist, by the way, and he wanted me to be sure I pointed out the status of the spotted wing fly. I see we're going to be updated on that soon. That's devastating ripe fruit, and he anticipates it's going to hit a whole bunch of fruit statewide and take a whack out of the profitability. Already in the pear industry, Sunny tells me that we've seen losses over 20%. So I'm looking forward to Director Koba's briefing on this particular pest here shortly. Our capacity to produce new or updated educational publications is reduced. That means Oregonians will have less access to information that can help them through web resources. In general, every extension position unfilled translates to fewer people served, reduced grant income that supports our work, reduced economic performance, reduced youth development, and a less ability to focus on sustaining natural resource qualities. So here's how we're coping. As we plan for efficiency gains going forward, we're thinning the soup and underway now trying to assess whether it's possible to regionalize some extension programs, work across county borders a little bit better, share expertise so we don't have to duplicate the kind of faculty we would hire county by county. We're also increasingly working across state lines. You'll begin to hear the phrase e-extension more and more often, where we're actually using electronic distance educational technologies in order to reach people with online educational resources. It doesn't work everywhere, but it has the ability to make us more efficient. And we're considering increased use of user fees, so we share the cost of delivering extension education for those topics and clients where it's appropriate to allow the users to share in the cost of delivering information. What's on the table are additional risks of further reductions. On average, every 1% reduction in the OSU Extension Service budget means about 16,000 fewer kids served through the 4-H program. We have extension agents covering larger territories, so that kind of reduces some of their efficiencies through the travel that's needed for them to cover. And we have longer response time to disruptive crop issues like insects and disease outbreaks. So I think I'll stop there with my recap and just try to respond to any questions or comments you may have.
Representative Van Norman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I do have a comment. I would like to say that for Hood River County, the Extension Service is vitally important. And the growers have actually tried to make up some of the gaps in the funding, but they have reached the point where they can't do that either. And the loss of these experiment stations, especially in Hood River County, and I have no doubt Clackamas County as well, which are two of my three counties, would be devastating. And they rely on the experiment station, especially for the research on insect control. So I'm a very strong supporter of my experiment station.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other comments? Yeah, Representative Beyer.
I guess while extensions have been, a number of extensions have been pretty successful at the local options, it does result in compression on the tax front with all other local governments. So is there any kind of a role for the legislature to play in funding because of the compression issue?
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Beyer, thank you for the question. Extension has a tradition of shared funding through all three levels of government. We receive a modest appropriation from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The state is our largest stakeholder and investor. And the counties have historically been looked to provide kind of the local resources that allows us to keep an office open in the county. And you're absolutely right, as we deliberate and seek the possibility of a more local tax basis, depending upon the circumstances in the particular county, it can result in compression. So we are working, as we have long done, with the Association of Oregon Counties in order to better refine what the concept of a local partner is and how the state and counties have this shared services model. So I think there is a conversation we might want to begin about that, about how the state can assist us in being sure that we have people living and working in Oregon communities where the real extension work is done.
Okay, you have gotten us back on time. So
my pleasure.
I wanted folks to hear, you know, some of the positive things that we do, but also understand the you know, the budget situation that they're under as of the moment. because I have been hearing about it as I've been traveling around the state. So I thought you could all share in it. Thanks, Scott.
And you're welcome.
We're going to take a break for 10 minutes, and then we will come back and hear about Drosophila Suzuki. My wife is very unhappy. Is named with a very similar. guess they didn't put us in recess. I just walked out. And,
no, I think you did.
Yeah. I'm good. Okay. And we're going to start up again with Katie Koba.
Katie Koba?
I forgot to tell you, I had a guy come to me, Tom Woody from my theater. He said, I had a dream about you today.
I hope it's morning again.
I still feel bad about telling you that. I should not have.
For the record, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture, with me is Helma Throg, who runs our plant pest disease.
It's my neighbor.
program in the agency. And,
it should have been named Drosophila Gilliami.
I'm not a professional scientist like Helmuth is. I just know this bug is really ugly and we don't like it. But before I turn it over to Helmuth to go through what we know about our newest pest, I want to take an opportunity, number one, to remind the committee that invasives are something that we are dealing with on a daily basis. You heard a lot about invasive species during the last legislative session, whether that's pests, diseases in plants, in animals, noxious weeds, you name it. I spoke to it a little bit earlier today. We've almost gotten to the point in the agency of identifying the pest or disease of the month, and we frankly expect these kinds of things to keep coming at us. Talked about it at our National Association meeting. There is some initial discussion because of concerns by all the states about invasives and how we fund them and the fact that the states are completely strapped about the idea of approaching a similar program, which is in the 2008 Farm Bill, the Specialty Crop Grant Program, which provides grant funds to states to promote specialty crops, to structure something along the lines of an invasive species block grant program that would send funds to the states to deal with invasive species. Very preliminary, but I just need to remind you that what you're going to hear about here in a minute with what I affectionately call the Dracula fruit fly, it's not a single isolated kind of thing, and we are going to continue to have this challenge in terms of dealing with invasives, whether it's from movement of people and goods or climate change and how that is going to impact invasives in the state. Secondly, I wanted to mention that the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Oregon State University put together kind of an informative get-together last week. For the industry to come in and hear what we knew about this new pest and what we didn't know. I think there were about 200 attendees at this meeting that was put together rather rapidly. And for those of you that read the Capital Press, it was featured on the front page of last week's Capital Press. And I think when Helmuth goes through the presentation, one of the things that's being stressed right now is the need for research and to identify tools about how to deal with this. But the fact of the matter is there is no money at the state level. We are in communication with USDA APHIS about whether there would be federal funds. I think one of the other things that we may want to consider is whether we come to the emergency board looking for money. But we all are very cognizant of what's going on with state funding right now. So just another piece of information. So before I turn it over to Helmuth to go through what we know about this new little bug, just wanted to see if you had any questions for me.
You and I.
Okay. We'll turn it over.
Rick and I were both concerned that for the month of February you not mention the Drosophila legislator as the pest of the month. So we just...
You only knew...
only Gilliam.
I'm Helma Drog with Oregon Department of Agriculture, Program Manager of the Insect Pest Prevention and Management Program, and I do respectfully have to say something about it's actually a beautiful insect.
Yes, right. Only beautiful.
But this is an entomologist speaking. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you an update on the Drosophila suzuki or suzukii, whichever you want to pronounce it, an update on this invasive species. And I want to give you a quick storyline or timeline. We received at the beginning of June of this year reports from our counterparts in California about a new pest that is affecting cherries. Didn't prevent California from sending the cherries to Oregon with that new pest, we assume.
Yep.
And we started immediately collecting fruits down south where we received fruits from California. That was around middle of June. And early July, this topic was so big, the National Plant Board called a national conference call with all the states affected, because also CDFA immediately said, don't worry about it. We found it. We intercepted it on fresh fruit coming from Oregon, from Washington, from British Columbia into California. So we went back out again, made more surveys, collected fruits around Oregon. We put out traps, and we immediately put an alert together, send it out to our colleagues from OSU Extension Service around the state to alert them about this new bug. And the first catches we got was about early August, where we collected it on fresh fruit, cherries, and then the last 3 weeks, we are just getting calls from pretty much everybody around the state, in particular around the valley, with more reports on that fruit fly. Now, since it is an invasive and exotic pest, there's some regulatory issues involved in that. So USDA APHIS got involved, but basically saying, throwing up their hands, it's a non-actionable and non-reportable pest to the feds. And as of today, so far, there is no restriction for either import or export of fruit concerning that invasive pest.
It is.
I apologize. California disappeared from the map here.
You have it in your...
You have it on... Yes, you have it. Unfortunately, the reality is different. Suzuki is basically everywhere in California. It has about 23 counties that is infected. And they found it already a year ago and presented the information earlier in June of this year. How about Washington? Washington did find it, but actually Washington is actually not looking for it. A CBP, a Customs Border Control agent, looked in his own backyard and found it, sent it in for identification. Hmm. And I met my counterpart actually yesterday in Boston from Washington State Department, and he said they're finding it everywhere and they don't even look for it. So Florida is the next on the list. They reported it in early August in one county so far. How about Oregon? So far we found it in about 9, very likely 10 counties, all the way even over eastern Oregon, Umatilla, and we confirmed it just a couple of days ago in Hood River as well.
Okay.
So it is very likely all over the valley on the west side. What about world distribution? Where does that pest come from? It originates in Southeast Asia. It's reported in Thailand. It's in China, Korea, and Japan. It is also reported in Europe, in Spain, and it is established in Hawaii. So what do we know about that pest? And this is the tricky thing, Drosophila, and that's why the feds don't consider it an invasive species, an actionable pest, because it's a fruit fly, it's a vinegar fly, that in general, that entire family of several thousand species affect only rotten fruit. But this is one of two species of the Drosophila genera or genus that affect actually fresh fruit. And it comes from Japan, so it is a temperate pest. It has no problem surviving the winters here in Oregon. And I want to point out reproduction rate. I always use, when I do entomology classes, I use the Drosophila fly. You can basically, with one couple, with a male and female, and you can see they can under best conditions, can have up to 23 generations a year. You can fill, if you pack them together in the size of a football, you can fill the space between the planet Earth and the Sun in 1 year. So this is quite impressive, the reproduction rate Drosophila flies have. And that is concerning. So here you have the life cycle. Female lays about 350 eggs in her lifetime. They develop through three different instar maggots. Then they pupate and finalize their cycle within about 10 to 15 days.
What does instar mean?
Instar is these, the larvae or the maggot is one instar. Instar is basically the immature stage of an insect. That's the developmental stage.
Okay.
An insect has to go through from the egg developmental stage through the pupae and then hatch into an adult. Excuse me. What do we know about hosts that are affected? It started with strawberries and cherries in California and pretty much affects all the cane berries that we know of. We heard about Asian pears. We have collected it on Asian pears. We are just trying to see if we can hatch them out of Asian pears. We collected them on grapes. We haven't hatched them out of grapes, so there's a difference. But the next few weeks will show what happens because we are collecting more fruits. And I have our list here for Oregon that we can confirm. We hatched them out of cherries, blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, and plums so far. And, oh, actually, peaches are missing here on that list. Peaches, we hatched them out as well. What makes it so different this time?
Beautiful.
That's what makes it different. The regular Drosophila, the vinegar fly, if you leave your banana too long on your kitchen counter, you can see them come out of your banana there. This particular Drosophila species has a serrated ovipositor that makes the female possible to puncture the skin of fruit and lay the egg underneath the skin of fresh fruit, and that's the maggot then go inside and eat the flesh and cause problems. How does that look like? You can see a little on the left-hand side, on the upper corner, is a cherry where the female scarred the cherry, and the maggot is inside causing damage to the fresh fruit still hanging on the tree. This damage opens up the cherry to secondary infestation, either by other insects or by mold. But the end result is basically the fruit is not marketable. This is how it looks like on plum. This is one of the maggot instars. I just want to show you a few photos how the damage looks like. You can really see the holes on this plum where the larvae then bores inside. This is out of here, a grower in the eastern part of Salem, where we collected peaches with damage. And this is how it looks like on the tree, where they come out in the hundreds out of the trees. And then internally, you see the damage on the peaches. So this particular grower had to actually stop his U-pick operation because 100% of his peaches were damaged by that new pest. And Katie already mentioned it. We held an informational meeting last Tuesday and invited OSU Extension Service, USDA APHIS, and USDA ARS, the research station from Corvallis, and the industry to disseminate and gather information what we know about that new invasive pest, develop next steps between OSU and ARS. What can we do? What are the potential risks for Oregon? And what could be the regulatory consequences? And what can we do about that new pest? So we came up with a few things. OSU and ARS are presenting at the moment research proposals. Again, the same thing. All depends on financing. If there's money, they can do some of the research already this fall to see what are the hosts, what are the life cycle. We don't know very much about that new pest, and what is the potential risk. So our message is we need to be very concerned about it because we need to be ready and alert about the situation. We don't need to panic about it. It could be something like the potato tuber moth that we had in 2004, 2005 in the Columbia Basin in Hermiston over there, where we had a huge outbreak of the potato tuber moth, a big pest of potato, obviously. And in 2006, it pretty much disappeared again into levels that where it didn't cause any economic damage. But this particular Drosophila could potentially be a nightmare to fresh fruit industry here in Oregon.
I have a question.
Representative Van Orman.
Representative Klim, thank you. Or Chair Klim, excuse me. Sorry.
No, you were first.
Okay. What is this going to do with organic farmers?
Representative, very good question, because since this pest affects fresh fruit that you basically harvest in a few days, there's not much you can do to spray on there before, and in particular organic farmer have very limited options. So OSU, ARS are working and considering these challenges with that particular pest. We have to look at best management practice, integrated pest management. It has to be a whole package from the beginning. So we are still at the beginning of that, what we can do. We heard, there's limited literature available from Asia, from Japan, that dates back to the 30s, and it is considered a pest in grapes, and it can wipe out some of the grape industry there. So we have no idea at the moment.
Thank you,
Chair Klim. I guess my question is, are we the only one that are in this process of looking at it and trying to figure out what we can do? Are there other states and maybe opportunities for cooperation on this?
USDA APHIS is encouraging all the states to do surveys. As I said, our neighbor to the north didn't even bother to look for it for whatever reasons, but they still find it. USDA APHIS is actually evaluating the regulatory aspect of that Drosophila, and I haven't mentioned it, but there are import permits for that particular species from Japan to some of the research stations here or universities. UC San Diego, for instance, receives this particular species for molecular studies. Now, this goes to certified labs where they're not allowed to let them out, but that's a different issue. But they're looking into that. So I'm not sure when this is going to happen. We will have probably a follow-up national conference call on that topic because it seems to be pretty much blowing up all across the country.
Thank you.
Mr. Winger.
I just want to, you're the scientist, but help me understand how confident we are that this is new. Have we been looking for it all along, and are you confident that we're seeing a brand new infestation, or could this be something that has been around in the background for a while and maybe dormant and flaring up, as you said, like the potato?
Very good question. That's always, of course, the next question that we have. How long has that been around? We have looked for that, but when we talked in the last few weeks to growers, they said we have never seen that before. So it could be around maybe a couple of years lying low, as you mentioned, on sub-detectable levels. And maybe this year we had the perfect storm. Production was ripe, the weather conditions were ripe, and all of a sudden this Drosophila can multiply so quickly in a very short time that all of a sudden this year it just showed up and had economic damage. So it could have been around for a while. But we probably, I mean, how did it get here? We don't know. It probably came in with fresh fruit imports from Asia, because the Customs Border Control does not look, it's, as I said, it's not an actionable pest. So if they find a maggot that turns out to be a Drosophila, it just comes in. It's not rejected.
Yeah, I guess I want to go back to life history. How long does an adult female live?
It can live up to about 60 days.
So
as far as we know.
My issue is how they have to have, so every 60 days there's got to be a reproduction process to get the next one, which means that there has to be fresh fruit all that time. I mean, has there come a point when no fresh fruit available?
Yes,
therefore,
sir.
They all die, so they're done.
No, they will overwinter.
That's
so,
okay.
Yeah. And we have lots of what I would call feral fruit here, the Himalayan blackberries, pretty much everywhere. So you have fruit pretty much all around the season. And then we don't know yet if they overwinter in the pupal phase or as an adult. There's reports out that they can do both. So they can hang around just like some of the ladybugs in your house and wait it out, and then next spring go back out. If there's a fruit available, they start up the new cycle.
Follow. So the next one is, in certain of these fruit flies, introducing a whole lot of sterile males or whatever can create a problem, so they don't reproduce. Is that possible in this one, or is it just so fastly reproduced and so big you couldn't produce enough of the males sterilized?
Yeah. With Drosophila, it's never been tried. We've done it with medfly, the Mediterranean fruit fly, and other real fruit flies, not with this vinegar fly.
Okay.
And considering their very short cycle, reproduction, one generation could be in less than a week. It's almost impossible to do.
And so my final one would be, in Japan and Southeast Asia, they've had this for a while. So do they have successful pesticides or other kinds of treatments for this from that part of the country?
I talked to our state plant health director, Mitch Nelson, and he worked in Asia for a while, and he said they pretty much nuked their fields.
Oh.
So they use methyl bromide as a fumigant and sterilize their field. So I don't know too much about their agriculture practices, but that's certainly something OSU and ARS will look into it in the next future.
Okay.
And do we know if there are either federally or I'm pretty certain there aren't in Oregon, but federally any relief programs as a part of crop insurance? Most tree fruits aren't eligible for crop insurance, first of all, but or maybe they are just recently.
Mr. Chair, I believe that they, under the new farm bill, they are, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on all this, and we can certainly get Brent to get a response back to you. I think you're required to sign up for insurance in order to be eligible for disaster relief. And then the disaster relief would be dependent on the extent of damage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Weather. Living in Hood River County, where it gets really cold and we have lots of snow for a few days of the year, it sounds to me as if they might not survive in that weather outside, but somehow if they get inside, they could survive and then get out again. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Yes, ma'am, that could be. But keep in mind that we get, in the early spring, we get fresh fruit from California. And we found it this year in June, July, we found it already in Portland. And remember, the last winter was pretty harsh. So either they survived easily under these conditions, or they were reintroduced again, from fresh fruit coming in through Canada, coming down here, or coming back up from California. So this is just guesswork at the moment. We don't know what the life cycle and how they can survive here. Not yet.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for the update.
Thank
you. It's obviously a matter of grave concern to a lot of people. But
bear farmer.
As worker Christina was her.
What's going to happen with
the wife of the peach grower sitting in the office?
Yeah. Marvin, can you join us? I'll try and see what I can do to get us back on schedule here. And I will remind folks, what's that? Okay. Remind committee members that your per diem form, if it's not here with you, then it's on your office doors, and you need to turn them in today before you leave, if you would like your per diem.
I don't think they're here.
Mm-hmm. Marvin.
Sir. Morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. Had three items that you mentioned on your list you wanted to discuss: fire season, sudden oak death, and the recent changes to the forest management plan, so I'll kind of take them in that order. Fire season, I'd say we've had worse in the last few years. Had pretty normal number of high-risk burning days, probably normal to slightly less than normal number of lightning busts. The end result was we stayed very busy, as usual, and dispatched two teams, one early in the summer north of Fossil, where a fire was getting into some rough country and beyond the capacity of the local district to deal with. And then the second one received a lot of publicity, burning west of Bossier, up along the gorge there, and had some impacts on highway traffic, evacuated the city of Bossier. And both of those we eventually were dealt with pretty successfully. I think we sent teams home within a week in both instances, but they were pretty challenging situations. The only other really of note from our action last week, late as last week, had fires threatening both the southern end of Medford and southern end of Ashland at the same time. We were pretty close to dispatching teams to that, but the local folks did just a super job applying air resources and tractor plows and actually got that stopped. I think in the end there was only one actual residential structure that was impacted. On the Bossier fire, there was one residential structure and a couple of outbuildings. No structures impacted on the Fossil fire. A big thing we watch, obviously, when we get into those busy fire days, is we start accessing what's called the Oregon Forest Landowner Protection Fund. That's $10 million that's set aside for emergencies. It has been $15 million at some points. Last session, it was reset at $10 million. The idea being that once we spend that $10 million, then the general fund is obligated to spend the next $15 million before we get into the insurance policy that we have. This year, we're bumping right at the $10 million right now. We're going to get some reimbursement from FEMA on last week's fires, probably $1 million to $2 million, something like that. And we've still got through June to go. So I think we're going to be just right on the edge of whether we access, come to the emergency board accessing general funds to get into that next quantity of emergency dollars. That's probably about the best summary I can give at this point, unless you have some questions.
Yeah. Representative Krieger.
Marvin, what were the causes of the Bossier fire and the other one you mentioned, Fossil?
I think Bossier was a transmitter.
Yeah, I'm reluctant because until we get a final report from the investigation, it's a little bit hazardous speculating on that. I think there will be some opportunities to claim costs on the Bossier fire. right now, I don't know that we're going to be having any opportunities to claim costs on the other three incidences that I said, but they're still under investigation. It's kind of a touchy area.
One other question. On either one of those two larger fires, were aircraft used?
Oh, yes, on all those fires. Mm-hmm. Used quite a bit. Aircraft are absolutely essential for us being successful. The heavy air tankers were where the terrain works right. That didn't work right in the gorge, but we had, I think, at one time about four helicopters going in rotation, and that certainly had a lot to do with keeping it out of the town.
Okay. Thank you. Representative
Verblin. Forest Service fires, are they keeping them in there in the federal lands and not causing us a problem? I haven't heard anything from that.
No, they're not keeping them in their lands, and yes, they are.
That's what I thought.
There's only been a couple of places that have really, really surfaced. One, early in the year, a fire on the Willamette National Forest, I think it was, or it could have been the Umpqua, it was in tough terrain, and it was going to be very difficult for anybody to get in there and stop it at their line. And it eventually, we all agreed the best thing to do was to back off onto some private forest land and put a line in and stop it there. And that ended up burning about 400 acres of private property. There's been a couple of other fires that we've, you know, wished they would go ahead and put out, but they haven't gotten to threaten, you know, they haven't been imminent threats yet. Just 2 days ago, a wilderness fire that's been going for about 2 months in Eagle Caps did blow out, and it burned some of Director Saliday's land up north of the Eagle Cap Wilderness. I had to inform her I don't know what the timber loss is going to be to the Common School Fund yet, but there will be some. So.
Representative Van Orman?
Yes, thank you, Chair Clem. I would like to say that the Mosier fire was actually pretty frightening. Mosier is renowned for lack of water. It's very dry there. And my imagination took off, and as it moves west towards Hood River, I could see it coming over Fir Mountain down into the orchards. And so the fact that it was contained, and I know that there were many farmers very grateful, because I thought it was pretty frightening.
I appreciate that, Representative Van Orber. Without overstating it, our folks do a really good job. They really do, and they get on the fires aggressively. They fight them in order to get out of there quickly. We don't like to have teams dispatched for weeks and weeks. We tell them, you know, we're sending you, and we want you home in a week, if at all possible, so that we want to get this thing out. And they did an excellent job there. I was over there on the Friday, I think, when it was the worst, and I had a lot of empathy for the folks in Mosier, because you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. The smoke was so thick coming down there.
Okay, you want to move on to the next portion?
Sure. I will cover sod, Southern Oak Def, a little bit. I believe you all got a handout, and that's what I'm speaking from, too. I'm going to hit some very quick highlights. There was some new infestations in the last year. It's amounted to about 15 acres. They are all within the existing quarantine area. We continue to do treatments between interruptions and funding. Overall, I'd say we don't feel like we've lost any major ground right now, even though we have had some funding interruptions. We've got some federal money on this. We've begun to run into some issues with the feds that all of a sudden they'd like to see matching dollars applied to this. And we've been exchanging letters. I challenge the fact that that's actually a federal regulation, that we need to match it, and I'm still waiting for an answer on that. Once we get an answer, Congressman DeFazio's office has expressed a great deal of interest, and we may have to ask them to weigh in on this issue if we can't get any satisfaction. But ultimately, there's another almost $3 million available, and we just got to get this part hammered out, and we hope we get it hammered out quickly so that we can pretty aggressively treat, you know, what's out there right now, which is the new areas, plus some 100 or so acres that didn't get treated last year. The only other thing I'd probably draw your attention to is down at the bottom of the second page, and I think this is just something to keep in mind over the long term, that even if we get over the hump and we kind of get to a consistent place, you're probably looking at somewhere between a $1.5 million and a $2.5 million program per year to keep this thing where it's at. I mean, that's just the reality. So.
Representative Krieger.
Marva, I don't know if Representative Nolan, but I'm speaking for you, if she is aware of what this was, how big, what happens if it spreads into the rest of Oregon, and its effect not only the timber industry, but the entire nursery industry, our ability to take products out of Oregon.
Correct, Representative Krieger. It affects both timber industry and the nursery industry. From the timber industry standpoint, it adds cost that they have to treat logs that are coming out of the quarantine area and going into other areas of the state where they can be processed into chips or wood. So that's certainly a cost that they have to incur, and it's not necessarily a cheap cost. I don't want to shortchange the concerns that the timber industry have on this, but probably the more significant economic potential damage is to the nursery industry. If it got into the valley, some of these high nursery producing areas of the state, and the nursery industry started having difficulty shipping ornamental stock, it would have a huge, huge economic impact on the state, and that's really what's driving a lot of this. Yes, sir.
Think of, Mr. Chair, an investment of $1.5 million, $2 million a year to protect a $1 billion industry is a good thing for a business model. Anyone that had that would be doing it.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You can answer that first, yeah.
I was just going to point out, in reference to what Representative Krieger just said, at on the second page, kind of in that third group down, the last bullet, there was some economic evaluations that have been conducted, and that last line points out that for every dollar spent on control and eradication, there's estimates that were benefiting anywhere from, $2.70 to almost $20. So,
do we have nurseries that are in this zone now in the Brookings area that are affected yet? Okay, that's what I was thinking too. So they are already under quarantine. I mean, they have to do special things with their product. Okay, and since we know it can be carried in azaleas and rhododendrons and some of our other more precious stock, right now we're talking what. We had a number of outbreaks. Was this a bigger outbreak than it was last time with the number of new cases? It looks a little bit high to me as a comparison to the previous one. It's still inside the quarantine area, which is nice.
It's not overly high.
Okay. And right now, California has it in most of the northern counties, and we have it in just one county because we have done what Representative Krieger just mentioned, put some money into it.
Yes.
So the other thing, I guess, there is stock, stuff that it can grow in every county in Oregon. So, I mean, if it gets out of here, it could affect every county. I look at what we're doing in Coos County. I mean, we're a little nervous. And Douglas, all these counties, because if it starts to move out of there, it's going to affect, that's how it moves. I mean, and it's waterborne. I'm one of those people that, along with Krieger, who really believes strongly that we have to invest now, keep it contained, not emulate what's happened in California. Do we know the nursery problems in California with respect to their industry? Have we heard?
I might invite my colleague from ODA to come up if he wants to answer that. He probably has a lot better information than I do. But.
Dan Hilburn, Oregon Department of Agriculture. So your question is, what is happening in the nursery industry in California? They have, I believe, 15 counties that are quarantined now, and all the nurseries in those counties are inspected monthly to maintain a certification that they don't have sod. So in this state, most of the shipping nurseries are visited annually, And if it were to spread, we would get into that monthly routine.
And if by chance they find a nursery where it is, what happens to that nursery?
There is a protocol for, it's called the confirmed nursery protocol, and it involves destroying all the plant material that's infected, all the plant material that's close to what's being inspected, putting on hold for 90 days all the plant material that is a potential host that they can't ship for 90 days, and reinspecting and retesting during those 90 days till the nursery's cleaned up, and then it's released. So it's very expensive. We've got six nurseries that have gone through that this summer. Two of them are still going through it. There's no reimbursement for the lost plant material, so it's very, very damaging to the nursery business when that happens on a nursery.
And my final one, who pays for the inspections that you have to do in those quarantined areas?
Chair Clem, Representative Nolan, right now all the inspections are done with federal money, so the federal government has supported this sudden oak death certification project.
Representative Van Orman.
So, in terms of prevention, what steps can be taken to prevent this disease other than quarantine?
Representative Van Orman, I have lots of ideas on that. There's some very, very interesting research going on at Oregon State University right now, Dr. Park and Dr. Nick Grunwald. And they're looking at nursery production and where the critical control points are in nursery production, where diseases are introduced to it. So I am cautiously optimistic that very soon we'll be able to redesign nursery production, and it needs to happen nationally so that all those critical control points are addressed and we're not continuing to share it through the nursery industry, which would protect the forests. That needs to happen. The research is ongoing. We're getting closer. Some of the things are really simple, like reuse of pots. If you have a plant that you put on the cull pile and you reuse the pot, the diseases carry through to what the next crop is in that pot. So there's some very simple things that nurseries are going to be able to do. Some of them are not so simple, and some of them are going to be expensive. Water and treatment of water that's reused for irrigation is going to be expensive, but it's going to need to happen because especially with water bags like this one, you can spread it through the irrigation.
Representative Roblin, come back to...
I guess my other question, and this is for Marvin, for some people who may not realize, how big an area when you find an infected tree do you have to nuke? Because it really, I mean, and what do you do? Because I think you cut everything down and burn it all, right?
Burn all of the potential hosts, for sure. And it's within 5 acres?
It's about 7 acres for a single tree.
Yeah. You have to cut it out and burn it to do that. It's very intensive eradication treatment.
So when you see this map, and you see the little ring, hole, the little deal around it, that's the area that they're cutting out and... as some people would like to say, totally clear-cutting, but not for a profit for anybody, just to heat up the atmosphere by burning it all up.
Yeah.
Representative Figure.
Well, 70% of Curry County is federal land, and this is, I believe, most of it's on private land now. And what's going to happen when this gets into the federal land if it goes east a ways?
So far, I think they've been able to maintain some treatments. In fact, one of the notes here on the front says treatments have been uninterrupted on the BLM and U.S. Forest Service land. So they have been able to get approval to do some treatments.
Good. That makes me feel bad.
Representative Van Orman, then Winger.
Thank you, Chair Clem. In terms of eradication, are we talking about fire? Burning the trees? Burning the area?
After you cut them down, then the best thing to do is to burn them. Yeah, just to eliminate the disease.
Okay, thank you.
It's not prescribed fire, you know, running through a tract of land. It's removing the woody material and burning it.
Okay. Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the woody material taken somewhere else for burning?
It's just taken to a safe place, you know, where you can burn effectively. It could be right there on site.
So there is no prescribed burn of any kind on the in the seven-acre circle where you find the affected tree?
No, that really wouldn't deal with the issue. You've got to, you know, it wouldn't totally consume the host that way.
Thank you. One more question. I want to understand what's happening on the government-controlled land, especially the federal land. You mentioned that it's uninterrupted, but how aggressively are they looking for it? I mean, obviously they have very large tracts of land to monitor. I'm just concerned.
And Dan may know more than I, but my impression has been they've been pretty close cooperators in the survey work that we've done because they've got a real concern, mainly because it is, frankly, more difficult for them to get work done, and they're very concerned about keeping track and finding it. I don't know, Dan, if you've heard any more than that. But
yeah, Representative Wingert, they have been good cooperators. They've been right at the table, and they have their own funding sources and their own teams that do the work. I believe that today there's an eradication project that's starting on a Forest Service piece of land near the Redwood Trail.
Correct.
That was found just a couple of weeks ago. They were very quick in getting the paperwork done, and I believe it's October 1 that they were going to address that. So up to this point, they've been good cooperators.
And you're confident that they're aggressively looking for it?
I believe they are. Yeah, like I said, their big concern is if it got to be a big problem, then it would get to be a big process for them to deal with it. So I think they're trying to invest money in detection to keep it from becoming that size of problem where you get into a huge process and analysis and everything.
Okay. Quickly, our last little update.
Oh, you still want to know about that?
Yeah. Always.
The final subject was recent actions by the board to change the state forest management plans. And I can tell you that at their June meeting, the board did approve the department to bring back some rule language that would modify the current state forest management plans. And we brought that rule language back in September, and the board approved us going forward with those modifications through administrative rule change. And, you know, to kind of boil down the essence of it, there's two sort of key metrics. One was the original plan said that it's presumed that we would pursue a habitat conservation plan with the federal services as a way to deal with endangered species, or if we elected not to do that, that we would develop a more robust set of strategies for species of concern. And our recommendation was to drop the habitat conservation plan and develop the more robust set of strategies for species of concern without involvement of the federal government. And the board accepted that recommendation. So we have developed, conceptually what those strategies for species of concern would be, and the board has conceptually agreed to that. The other key metric that was at play, a lot of what we were able to do in the way of implementation was driven by a stated goal in the plan to achieve over a period of time 40% to 60% complex structure on the forest. At the time that the board approved that, the projections were that you could do that and you could also achieve about 280 million board feet of timber harvest a year. And as you all are well aware, we've never been able to achieve that level of timber harvest with that goal in place. We've averaged about 185. Actually, by changing how we go about identifying and sort of focusing complex habitat, that number looked like it was going to need to drop even further. And the choices that the board had were to keep the goal for habitat complex habitat at that roughly 50% level, and we're probably looking at about 145 million feet of timber harvest, you know, roughly half of the original projection. The other thing we could do is go for the 280 million board feet of timber, and the habitat goal was going to only be about 10%. So, you know, what we ended up recommending was what we thought a reasonable compromise, a reasonable balance that kind of lowered everybody's expectations to a level where we think the plan actually can produce what it says it needs to produce. The end result is going to be a timber harvest that's about 70% of that original projection. And the complex habitat range that was 40 to 60 is now 30 to 50, and that's about 75% of what the original objective was. We feel like that was a reasonable way to go forward. And without boring you with a lot more detail, the other important thing that the board directed us to do was to start re-looking at the administrative rules that guide the development of those plans. There's a whole set of rules that talk about, you know, what does greatest permanent value mean? How do you go about structuring a plan? What does the plan need to include? And I feel like that needs to be viewed as one of the reasons why we got to the point we did in 2001. And so the board has agreed to take a good, strong look at those sets of administrative rules and see if they really are functional for what we're trying to do.
Representative Krieger.
Marvin, I'm sitting here, I can't. And you were our state forester at the time.
Thank you.
I was on the board when they started. Vic Baldwin and I told him back in 2001 and 2, you will not stay with the Habitat Conservation Plan because you can never reach your goals. Oh, yeah, we were right. The second part of it was the amount of projections that Dr. Sessions said we were going to get under that plan. I had told him at the time, I can get two loggers, a case of beer, and come closer than you did. And I was right. I was also told when they played around with the definition of greatest permanent value and the purpose of the lands rule, they were making a mistake. We were right. We've gone back and you've done it all. So sometimes I think you, as you know, the head of the agency and your professional people, need to have a good long conversation with the people that have been out in the brush, in the woods, doing that for a living for 30, 40, 50 years. Not saying that you wouldn't, because you've been there in the private sector. But I think that's, you know, why did we wait 8 years? We wasted 8 years, 9 years. And now we're going to go back and do it. We told you should have done to start with. I think it's a good lesson for us. And that happened for one reason, is that board worked by consensus. Without that, that wouldn't have happened. You never had the votes.
Thank you. You've given me lots of landmines that I don't think I'll step on right now.
Our next agenda item anyway.
This is a really quick one. It just has to do with that. You're the state forester, so that's state forest lands, but we've got the Elliott Forest, and we've been pursuing an HCP on that one for many millions of dollars.
9 years.
9 years and many millions. Are we going away from that now and moving back to this, or have we decided yet?
That's a good question, Chair Clem, Representative Robleit. We're in the throes of trying to figure out where we want to go with that. We have been in that process for 9 years now. We felt like we had good engagement from the federal services from beginning to end, to the point where it was just going to be sign on the dotted line. You know, we all agree that these are the right strategies. And as we've gotten to what we hope to be the end of the process, all of a sudden we're hearing from them, no, maybe these aren't the right strategies. And it's quite frustrating. My fear is, in the end, you know, they're going to, you know, they're not going to win, and we're not going to win. It's my fear right now. But it's a decision that's going to be strictly up to the land board, and we're trying to develop a recommendation for them for that'll come back probably within 3 or 4 months.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. One of the interesting experiences I had on my nursery tour last week was. It suddenly was a shift in my thinking, because having been a city commissioner, I spent a lot of time with people who were struggling about every tree being cut. And suddenly at this tour, I realized we really should maybe be focusing on planting trees, because that's an important part of, I think, supporting trees in industry. Because I think one of the things that happens, trees will die. And what are we doing to replace those? And so for me, it was like an aha moment that if I were a city commissioner again and had that responsibility for land use, I would certainly be talking about what are we doing as a city to promote more tree planting.
I really appreciate that question. It's since I've been here, one of the areas that I've looked at as a real shortcoming for our department is we don't have an urban community forestry program that's very substantial. We basically operate on a meager amount of federal funds that we get every year, and I think there is a real important role for the agency to have in that area from several standpoints. One is 80% of Oregonians live in urban areas, and so there's, you know, as that trend continues, there's fewer and fewer opportunities for us to really interact with who are the most significant set of decision makers in the state, and my fear is, you know, forestry as a whole becomes less relevant when we have less interaction with them, and I think urban community forestry really offers that opportunity. The other is there's a real viable set of human and resource benefits that are delivered from the trees in those areas. And right now, we're simply, nobody has the resources to pay attention to those, to see that as subdivisions occur, we're still planning for good fish habitat, for good water quality, for maybe even, you know, potential timber management in some areas at some point down the road, not capturing the energy benefits that trees present, a whole host of things. I think there's a real opportunity there that's being missed right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Yep, Representative Krieger.
Marvin, as I recall, we are pre-planning on industrial lands at 99%, give or take, and 98 plus 6 or something like that on private non-industrial. We're still about in that same percentages, aren't we?
We are, Representative Krieger. That's, in general, pretty good reforestation. The problems that we run into are actually in these urban interface areas where, you know, they're kind of on the cusp of whether it's even going to be a forest in the future or not, and folks are reluctant to reinvest in things.
Representative Roblin, just to follow up the last part of that question, and the reforestation on the federal lands after the fires and stuff?
Well, they have to harvest first, but... Sorry for playing the audience.
No, that's good. I like that.
Longer plan is called rot, reburn.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what their success is. I know in a lot of instances it costs them a lot more money to do reforestation because of some of the constraints they have. But I have seen reforestation on their property, particularly BLM.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the updates on these conflicts. And I'll get House Bill 2761 out of the way. I don't think there's anybody here to testify on it unless I'm missing something. This is a bill that we passed out. It had to do with trying to get better quality of, better control, I guess, over who's out there doing soil assessments on agricultural lands, and we had a recommendation to try and have a registry of folks who are accredited to applicants who are looking to get their soils tested would have a pool to pick from, and the bill passed out of the House, I think it was 60-0, and then it got sent down to Ways and Means and just died for lack of time. So it's something I want to flag for people to take a look at if there's any new concerns over it or ideas for it, but it might be something that comes back in 2010 in the February session as a committee bill. But since we have no one here to talk about it, we won't take any more time with it. And House Bill 3298A, which was morphed into something else later, but this was a bill that just deals with urban-rural land reserves, which is there's a process going on in the metro region around it, and then there's some other things in the statute about it that are used in other parts of the state. But I wanted to have we did not at the time have – we were moving quickly. We did not have a very robust conversation because the bill morphed into another bill in the Senate. I wanted to have some folks get a chance to talk who didn't get a chance to talk the original time. And then we probably will have a public hearing on the topic in November, potentially, post-Metro making some decisions so we can get some feedback on how it's working from the relevant parties' point of view. But we'll get a little preliminary take on that, I'm sure, at the moment. So I've got Randy Tucker, John Chandler, Sean Cleave, and Jeff Stone. Randy and John, do you want, we don't, well, no, now we do have four. Do you want to all just come up? Yeah.
Put me on the left again.
Yeah.
For you.
My right. Typecasting.
Should have gotten my
phone. And look who's on the right.
And let's see. How about we mix it up a little? I've got Randy and then John, but since the microphone is there, why don't we go Randy and then Jeff, and then let you guys switch seats or move the mic over or something else, and then we'll do Sean.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. And I'll try to be fairly brief and leave, because I think you probably have more questions than I am going to be able to anticipate. So let me just do two things very briefly. First of all, with respect to House Bill 3298, just refreshing your memory, as you said, there wasn't really much testimony on the bill, Mr. Chair, and our position on the bill was neutral. The bill just, I guess I should just say, what was the bill? Because we didn't, it would have prohibited the designation, after we designate urban reserves this time, assuming we are successful in that endeavor, the bill that came out of your committee would have prohibited the designation of any additional urban reserves until at least 50% of the ones that we're designating now have been brought into the urban growth boundary. And when in discussion with my colleagues here on the panel, in the development of that legislation, we were okay with it at the 50% level, and that's where we went neutral and were, you know, stayed out of the way, basically, of the bill. One of the reasons that we had concerns if that number was any higher was because there's a lot of uncertainty going forward about what the world is going to be like, and we're trying to account for that in the work that we're doing to designate urban and rural reserves right now. One of the things that we're doing differently in this process, not only with respect to the reserves but also the urban growth boundary, is with how we're doing our population and employment forecasts. In the past, we've said for our UGB expansion or UGB discussions, we've said 20 years from now, we're going to have this many people and this many jobs. It's been a point forecast, which obviously is fictitious because no one can predict 20 years into the future exactly what's going to happen. What we've done this time instead is that we've predicted a range, and that range gets wider as you go 40 to 50 years into the future for urban and rural reserves, of course. We're trying to concentrate the decision-making in the middle third of that range, which is a reasonable expectation of where things actually will turn out. And also something that is probably more defensible in the long range, assuming that there's litigation around these things, which there usually is. We are, we're building into our processes the idea that we don't know what's going to happen really in the future. There is uncertainty. And so we're trying not to tie the hands of people in the future too much on the things that when there's a, we're trying to look at the risks of doing that at any rate, risks of over designating or under designating either urban or rural reserves given the uncertainties that we face. And so the bill If it had been, you know, 70 or 80% has to be used up before you can do any more, we felt that that was problematic, and we were able to step aside at 50%. So I think that's all I have to say about House Bill 3298 itself. I'd be happy to give you a short update on the process that's going on in the Portland region right now, if that's of use to you. But maybe you'd like to do it a different way, Mr. Chair, and come back to that in a bit, or however you what's your pleasure?
I actually think it might help just for people to know right where we're at, you know, at this moment, because we're at a pretty key moment.
And my colleagues here, actually, let me just, as a caveat before I get going, I was very involved in the passage of the bill, Senate Bill 1011 in 2007 that creates the process that we're in now. I was very involved in the rulemaking to get that bill implemented. I'm personally much less involved in the discussions right now that are going on. I haven't been a member or, you know, even attending all the meetings of the Reserves Steering Committee that my at least two of my colleagues here on the panel have been members of and participating. So they may have some additional amplification of anything that I might say. Let me just say that the Senate Bill 1011, passed in 2007, establishes a process for the designation of urban and rural reserves through agreements between Metro and the three counties in our region, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. Nothing can happen unless there are agreements between Metro and the counties. So there wouldn't be any urban reserves or rural reserves designated under this legislation unless we agree. With our partners in this process, established a large steering committee that involves other entities, both public, private, and nonprofit, that are not official decision makers like we and the counties are, but that have a major stake in the outcome. That committee has been meeting for a year and a half, something like that, going on 2 years, on a monthly basis. The three counties in Metro, which are colloquially known in this process as the Core Four, have also been meeting. There's a designee, rather, from each of those bodies that is the official representative on the Reserve Steering Committee and is basically charged with working this out and bringing it back to their respective governing bodies. And they've been meeting also, you know, in between. They've been guiding the process of the Reserve Steering Committee and meeting in between to try to work toward resolution. There's been an assessment of the suitability of lands around the Metro's urban growth boundary for both urban and rural reserves. The study area was about, I think, 400,000 acres. Correct me if I get this wrong, you guys. Based on that suitability assessment, each of the bodies has come up with the governing bodies have not all acted, but at least at the staff level there is something on the table from each of these four bodies recommending, if you add them all together, if you add the three county recommendations together, you come out with a total of about 45,000 acres of urban reserves and I think something like a couple hundred thousand acres of rural reserves. Don't take that as gospel, but I think on the urban side, I think I'm pretty darn close there. Then a couple of weeks ago, Metro's Chief Operating Officer Michael Jordan released a set of integrated recommendations that relate to this process and several other development and growth management processes that have been ongoing for a few years, including the Regional Transportation Plan, the Urban Growth Report, which is focused more on how much capacity we need to provide in the urban growth boundary in the short run, for 20 years of growth, and also an investment strategy to help us figure out how to actually accommodate those people, you know, by providing the infrastructure that's needed to support them, people and jobs, I should say. So that sort of large integrated recommendation, which altogether fills two big three-ring binders, came out a couple of weeks ago, and on the urban and rural reserves side, Michael Jordan's recommending something in a range of 15,000 to 29,000 acres of urban and rural reserves. So where we are right now is that the governing bodies are, or the Core Four is starting to hash through that and figure out how to reconcile the different recommendations. The Reserve Steering Committee has one more meeting coming up next month, and there'll be basically presentations from participants to the Core Four, which will then, in theory, hash out an agreement and bring it back to the governing bodies. There's also been several rounds of significant public involvement so far. There have been many public workshops and meetings, and as the decisions become official going forward, the Metro Council is currently having a series of council meetings where they're inviting testimony on the overall recommendation of the chief operating officer. Those will go on until the last one is October 15th. And then when there's actually a resolution on urban and rural reserves that would represent the agreement between the counties, there would obviously be public involvement on that, because that would involve official actions by Metro and the three bodies, official land use decisions. So I guess the big policy questions out there right now are, how big are the reserves going to be? What's the regional sort of balance around the region? And are there going to be, and how much land would be designated as neither urban nor rural reserve? And, you know, those are, I guess, the questions that would have been there from the very beginning. They're not just new questions. So that's just a sort of a summary of where we are. We're expecting, I think, to come to some kind of a conclusion of this process, maybe not technically, but at least politically, with agreement by the end of the year. The technical process may continue after that. And once there's an agreement and everything, all the T's have been crossed and I's dotted at the local level, it goes to LCDC for acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think? Did I get that?
Should have been shorter.
Yeah. I guess I always, I think I'm guilty of starting by saying I'll be brief and then never being brief. Guilty as charged.
Me too.
It was fast, though.
For you, yes. Mr. Chair, Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I do serve on the steering committee. It has taken 18 meetings, 18, to finally come to a point where we're talking about trade-offs, about where commercial and industrial land should and should not be, the value of agriculture. It's been a robust discussion. And to take you back to 2007, it was unique to have all four of us push to pass Senate Bill 1011. And many in the agricultural side, they see it as this generation's Senate Bill 100. That there are opportunities to define where growth and agriculture either coexist or collide. And so I think it's an important process, and I'm glad that this committee is having at least a check-in on the process today. There's a lot of reconciliation to go on between what Metro and the three counties wish to do in terms of what they want to be, where they would like to grow, the role of agriculture as an industry, and how that is a part of all of that. I think that the numbers are big, the urban reserve numbers and the rural reserve numbers. I think you'll see those get refined over the next month. But the thing that I'd like to throw out there that has been instructive, and then I'll ask Sean to kind of amplify that, since we both share time on that committee, is the role of undesignated lands. If you have urban reserves and rural reserves, there is a swath of land that is not designated. Now, that can make both people who wish to grow and agriculture both nervous. If you apply your most paranoid process question into play about what it means for those undesignated lands, there's a gulf there that still needs to be covered. The great thing, I mean, from agriculture's point of view, there's polls aplenty that show that people want to protect farm and forest land. The most recent one I saw was up over 77%. However, you talk to those same people about active farming, it may be a different answer. I mean, they like the idea of farming. They like it as a noun, not a verb. And the nursery and greenhouse industry, in particular, is urban and rural. So we have a lot of folks. Representative Van Orman mentioned about her tour out at J. Frank Schmidt. That's an area that is flat, near an urban area, that if you didn't try to protect it, it would be next. over time, when you're looking at a 50-year horizon, and then you're talking about trade-offs. But it's important that we try to have a balanced approach. We want to do something different, and that's what Senate Bill 1011 did. That's why I think it was informative that the bill that you introduced, Representative Clem, 3298, talked about, and I think that the 50% designation tried to get at the undesignated portion, but since we really didn't have a big, long hearing on that, I want to not ascribe motive or anything else. But I think that we have, they've come a long way. I've heard some of the same speeches for 15 years around that table, but I think the opportunity here is to do something different, and so I think we should try to do just that. So I won't prattle on and go on to my good friend, either Mr. Chandler or Mr. Cleave.
John, get to talk. We would be missing out greatly if the committee ended without Mr. Chandler getting to thrill us. Please, not so much.
No. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and due to good thinking on our organizational part, I have not had to participate in this process as is unfolded out in the metro area. I have my Portland Home Builders Association been very actively involved in the discussions and potential fistfights that Mr. Stone described. It is a fascinating process. When we did 1011 in 2007, it was with the intention, as Mr. Stone mentioned, of trying to look at this very controversial, very difficult issue, economically difficult, politically difficult, financially difficult issue of how you move boundaries, where you put the growth, where you protect the resource land, so on and so forth. And I was struck when Mr. Stone was speaking that we have the exact same problem that agriculture has in the reverse. Most folks, as he says, are very fond of farming as a noun. They don't like it as a verb. On our side, everybody likes density as long as they don't have to live in it or next door to it. And you know, as former and potentially future Governor Kitzhaber once said, that two things Oregonians hate, one is sprawl, the other is density. And this whole process is trying to figure out how do you structure the largest community in our state up in the metro area, 24 cities, parts of three counties, how do you structure that? How do you add land to it in a way that doesn't affect the resource base, doesn't affect the transportation system unduly, creates livable communities, vibrant economies, so on and so forth, without irritating pretty much everybody in the process? I think where we are so far in these two big binders that Mr. Tucker mentioned is right about to the point where you start irritating people, would be my guess, which is part of the reason I'm very happy not to have to sit through the 18 meetings, and I will cheerfully show back up here in 2011 and squawk about what they did. At least that's my expectation. When 3298 came forward, the Ingros version, the concept of it, of looking at half the urban reserve not being having to be added to a boundary prior to any more being added, and I'll just state for the record the same thing I said in the Senate when the bill went over there last session. Conceptually, we don't have a particular problem with that. It's one more metric in a series of metrics. The only concern I'll state for the record, Mr. Chair and members, is in the particular it could be problematic simply because the area, the Portland metropolitan boundary, is so large. And it could end up with a development area in Washington County being held hostage to a political or financial or some other situation outside of Gresham on the other side of the metropolitan region. And if there were to be that kind of a discussion where you have some kind of a metric within the discussion of half or half, something like that, that we'd want to have it be regionalized to the area where the problem was existing or the problem you're trying to solve existed, simply because it is such a large boundary. If we were dealing with sub-regional or, excuse me, with the urban reserves in a smaller community, which by law we can't yet, it wouldn't be, I don't think, be troubling for us at all. It actually kind of makes sense so you don't just continually add urban reserves without actually doing the hard analysis of how you urbanize the stuff that you've made into a reserve. Adding reserves is kind of fun. It's colors on a map, and it has good discussions. Figuring out how to run water and sewer and pipes and schools and all that can be very, very expensive and very, very difficult. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a good process. As far as I can tell, I'm watching it with one eye. My Portland folks are active participants. I get asked questions periodically. I think it's going along well. I think Metro's doing a good job. I don't think the people who are participating on the Core 4 get paid anywhere near enough to do so, but I think it may be something we'll check back in with you about, I suspect, both this interim, perhaps, but before the 2011 session, as it gets more robust in the discussions. More than happy to take questions if I can be of further benefit.
John, Chairman.
Thanks, Chair Clem. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd just like to state out, I actually don't sit on the steering committee. I'm an alternate, so if things go really bad, it's Mr. Stone's fault.
We'll play.
The Farm Bureau has been engaged in the process, both on a statewide level and on a county level. I want to echo something that Mr. Tucker said, and this is why Farm Bureau is interested in the process, because it does potentially provide more certainty to our land use planning system. Because it isn't a UGB expansion, this is something I have to remind my members of all the time. It's not if you'll grow, it's where you'll grow, which is kind of a paradigm shift, which we always have to refocus the discussion during our meetings on a monthly basis. But through the process and through some of the mappings that have been developed, there has been a lot of discussion amongst my members that would indicate that this potentially has the effect of making the certainty go away. And that was our interest in the 50% concept that was introduced in the Ingross bill. How do we at least provide a mechanism to provide greater certainty through the process? And 50% seemed like a good place to start. I have heard from some of my members who lease property in the Washington County level area that that owners of the property have asked that the farmer not plant a perennial crop because they'll be brought into this region, and that will affect what the owner of the property intends to do with the farmland. So whenever you draw boundaries, there are ripple effects, and those are the things that we're concerned in. I do think Metro is doing a good job coordinating and dealing with some of the fistfights that may or may not come in the next couple months. But I'm very happy that this committee is continuing to look at what's going on up in the metro area. And as all things happen in Oregon, the metro area is usually a test ground for policies and procedures, and we'll probably see other reserve designations throughout the state. So with that, I'll open up to any questions.
Questions? Representative Nolan.
When there are fistfights, and if there become fistfights in this, I suspect it's not just because of academic or discussionary issues. It's because somebody, the very first item we had this morning, Mr. Chair, somebody's got a livelihood at stake. Whether it is a nursery operator or a farmer or someone who wants to build a factory or a subdivision, we typically don't get to fistfights here in Oregon over academic questions. We get there because there is a tension. And I think the entire agenda today has reminded us it's a question of how, not whether, and we have to address that issue. And we are better off not just boiling the frog slowly and doing a lot of studies about why the frog's health is deteriorating, but making a decision of whether we're actually changing something and dealing with those consequences, or whether we're going to try to pretend that the decision can be postponed. And I think at some point we have to come to grips with that we're going to make some tough choices. Metro is, or the counties are, or individual cities are, individual counties around the state. There's a tension that's becoming unavoidable. Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other comments for the good of the order?
Okay, well, thank you. I just wanted people to get a sense of where we're at now. I knew there's some stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks. We'll probably be revisiting again in November with a chance for people to weigh in on how they felt about it at that point, because there's some of them that want to. And thank you all for your time and attention. We got everybody here. Two of us are headed off to foreign country here in a couple of days, so if we don't return intact, it's been Wingard and I.
Really?
Then we'll put Representative Roblin. Oh wait, I'm sorry. In charge, and of you.
No, you
and
Susan.
Yeah, yeah.
In charge of double team. You need the double team.
So both you two in charge of him.
Did you already adjourn?
What's that?
Did you already adjourn?
See?
Thanks.